And episode 4, House of the Dead, is over. But we are just getting started on post-show recaps. My name is Jessica Leese, and we're about to walk you through all the good, the bad, the borderline offensive, and the positively baffling pieces of this episode, as well as do our best to put it all into some kind of context for you. And to help me out with this extremely difficult job, please welcome a guy I found helping a bunch of month-old corpses do a jigsaw puzzle, man of science, Rob Sesternino.
Yes. Okay. Is this the meeting?
Yeah.
Can I speak to the group?
Yeah. Go right ahead. You're the one that's good at work in the crowd.
Okay.
Rob.
All right. Well, first, I want to give a shout out to all of the our patrons that are out there. Shout out to you. Since everybody stand up, give yourself a round of applause.
Yeah, could we get the $5 patrons to stand up first, and then the $10 patrons, $15
patrons? I want to give a shout out to everybody who has been responding to us on Twitter. Give yourself a round of applause also.
Hey, Rob, is this why they call the book The Stand, because of this
yes,
scene?
Stand up. Just, what is the House of the Dead?
Is this
the
referring
titular
to...
titular House of the Dead.
Is this referring to Hemingford Home?
Yeah. It's kind of dark.
Yeah, that is a little dark, but I did have a lot of questions about the hygiene issues of a 108-year-old woman hanging out in a nursing home with a whole bunch of corpses and evidently having done nothing to try to move them around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or going to a different room.
Yeah, just hang out in your room. You don't have to sit in the living room with them.
Was Hemingford Home always an old age home?
No, Robin, this is a really interesting thing that I definitely want to discuss.
Daughter Abigail said, Mother Abigail, we're putting you in the Hemingford home.
Yes, exactly. But speaking of homes, Rob, I think before we go too far down this road to Colorado,
yes,
I want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. And those are our friends over at Geico. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do, and I bet it can be hard work. But you know what's easy? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. And Rob, you know, I feel like the Mother Abigail of the 1994 miniseries would probably be more inclined to look to Geico because she still owned her own home. In fact, she still baked her own bread every day.
She baked her own bread. Yes. Yeah. She wasn't in the home.
Yeah. And I wonder, I wonder if this is just a shortcut to not have to deal with building a set in Nebraska. But it could also be kind of a statement about the state of elder care in 2020 as opposed to 1994.
Hmm. I guess so. That's wild. Yes. When we saw Nick Andros look at the poster, not only was it hey, is that Stephen King?
It's totally Stephen King.
Yeah. And then also, Hemingford Home was a nursing home.
Yeah. I thought that was clever because Hemingford Home seems like a weird thing to name your town and or homestead, but this seemed to fit in very seamlessly. It was one of the better ideas they've had. It's just it kind of takes some agency away from Mother Abigail, doesn't it?
Yeah, a little bit that they would put her in this facility, sure.
Yeah, and then the Mother Abigail we get is also she isn't sure that people are actually going to come for her.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, wow, I guess I'm going to be one of these corpses one of these days. I'm going to join you guys in the afterlife. I don't think anybody's coming for me anymore. It's like, how do you not know people are coming for you? You've been showing up. You've been traveling to their dreams like Freddy Krueger every night for 2 months. Mm-hmm. It seems like you should be aware that you're doing that and you should know that they're going to follow through on that. You know who they are when they show up. Mm-hmm. How do you not know they're coming?
Yeah. So, Mother Abigail, she had some doubts.
Yeah, she did. And I guess, it's that sort of doubt being the essence of faith. You can't really have one without the other. And they are trying to humanize her a little bit more so she's not just this very supernatural creature. But, she's supposed to have magical healing powers and she's supposed to, intuit who is good and who is bad. And I feel like if she's really good at figuring out who she wants on her team, she's got to know that the people on her team are going to come for her before she dies, unless she thinks she's in a giant hallucination and it's just her last gasp before she kicks it.
No, I didn't get that.
Yeah, I didn't either. I feel like Mother Abigail should be a little more aware of what she's about and what's about to happen.
Yeah. Just for me, this was not the episode I was expecting to get this week.
No, I wasn't either, for a few reasons. But I got to ask you, episode 4, weakest of the series so far.
Yeah, I think so. It's probably, you know, a toss up with the first one. Although the first episode had, you know, like, oh, this is unsettling, but I don't like how they did this. And there's a few things that I do like here, and I'm interested to see where it goes, where I feel like that overall, you know, we just spent a lot of time with the Boulder Council. We were picking out our spies. We, you know, flashback to, you know, not great stuff on the road with Franny and with Harold, and a hostage situation, which was very troubling. So we had no Randall flag in this episode.
Yeah, that's disappointing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not a very sexy episode on that front.
Yeah. So I really felt like that this was the most, you know, like peace movery, except that they didn't really move. This was like peace, peace standing still ish episode.
Yeah, this is really, Rob, it's like that that meme about I survived another meeting that was supposed to be an email. Mm-hmm. I think all of these meetings should have been emails.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm still enjoying the series, but I just felt like that I think this one gave me the least.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you on that front, Rob. But I think we are here to give everybody the most out of this podcast. We got a lot to talk about. And I also wanted to let everybody know before we get too deep into the weeds, I wanted to let everybody know that you should stay tuned after Rob and I wrap up, because I've got some extra content for you this week.
Ooh.
Award-winning novelist Meg Ellison is going to be joining me to give her thoughts about the series so far. And Meg has written a series of novels called the series is called Road to Nowhere. The first installment is The Book of the Unnamed Midwife, and it chronicles the aftermath of a world-ending pandemic. And you are never going to guess, Rob, what book was a huge influence on her and inspired her to write a pandemic novel.
Was it Carrie?
It was Carrie, and it was Cujo a little bit too. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be able to talk about all of that. And I know she's been live tweeting her experiences watching The Stand, and she has a lot of really hot takes. So I think that's going to be a lot of fun. But you and I, before we do that, you and I have a lot to talk about here.
Okay. Where do you want to start?
I want to start with something we didn't see this episode, and I am kind of surprised that we didn't. And a little bit angry, if we're going to be honest.
Okay.
We're going to talk about the way that this show presented itself as we are going to gender flip some of the characters to make it more diverse.
Mm-hmm.
And what they didn't tell us, what they didn't finish in that sentence was, we're going to gender flip some of the characters, and then we're going to completely purple them so that anything that their male counterparts did in the novel, we can just cut that out and let somebody else do it. And they're just going to kind of be there. Mm-hmm. So we have given you some new token women in the series, but we don't have to make them do anything. And this is just baffling to me, because I feel like Ralph Brentner, the character in the novels and in the miniseries, had like maybe two important things that he does throughout the whole story. And they have already decided that Ralph's female equivalent in this series, Ray, didn't do one of those things.
Yeah.
Because the notion is that Tom and Nick are on the road, and Tom still does not know Nick's name because Nick can't convey it to him. And they are saved on the road by Ralph Brentner, who's like, this is your friend Nick. And then they are like, all three of them are best buds.
Yeah.
And they just decided that's not important, which, yeah, kind of not. But if you're going to make a big deal out of taking this character and gender flipping him so that there are now more women in the cast, you need to give them something else to do. And we have seen Ray Brentner twice now, and she said one thing each time. So I had hoped this episode that, you know, we got Glenn's episode last week. And we got Larry's episode the week before. And of course, week one is Sue and Franny. I was really hoping that this was going to be, we're going to get a really cool Genesis story for Ray Brentner. We're going to find out what her deal is. She's going to join the group. We're going to see why she's there. But she's not even on the committee, Rob. What is up with that?
No. I don't even know who was, I mean, was she one of the people that they sent to be a spy?
No, she wasn't. See, Rob, you don't even remember who she was, which is also a problem.
Was she one of the people that was that survived the encounter with the jackknife tractor trailer guy?
No.
So I don't even know who she was.
Yeah. See, that's the thing, Rob.
Where was she?
I was looking for her and I did not find her, except she hangs out in Mother Abigail's house and is like the bouncer. So Nick is the voice. Nick communicates and he comes out and he says, Mother Abigail says this, Mother Abigail says that. And Ray Brentner like sits in the living room and is like, okay, everybody, that's enough Mother Abigail time. Everybody goes home. And that's pretty much all we've seen of her so far.
Okay.
And it looks like we've seen in promo materials, and again, like people that are looking to not be spoiled about events, maybe you shouldn't watch a show that's told its story out of sequence, but we have seen promo materials that show four people doing like the Wizard of Oz style walk to Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And those four people are Larry and Stu.
Yeah.
And Glenn and Ralph. Ralph slash Ray. Mm-hmm. And what is Ray doing there? Why is she the fourth person if we aren't going to be told anything at all about her?
Is it possible that we still get her backstory?
I think it's possible, Rob. We're just about at the halfway point of this series, mm-hmm. and we have hit a lot of the main points that are not the titular stand. Mm-hmm. So if they're going to flesh out some more characters and give us more information, I could certainly see that being part of next week. And I could certainly see that Mother Abigail initially intended Nick to be that fourth person. And then she's like, well, we're going to need to call someone up from the bench. I think that might be what happens. But if that happens, if she's just like there the whole time, if she's just like, you know, they hide her face with a branch like she's Purple Kelly, I'm going to find that pretty baffling. Mm-hmm. Give her more to do. If you're going to care about this character enough to change their gender, give us a backstory.
Yeah.
Give us something.
Okay. We'll keep an eye on it. Still more stand to go than not. We're only 4 out of 9. 4 out of 9 is the 4 out of 9 equals out. 5 out of 9 is in.
That's right. Good mathing there,
that's
Rob.
Good math. Yeah.
It's very good math.
M-O-O-N, that spells math.
It's true, but there's a lot this week. It's weird that we're getting to this point here. It doesn't seem like it's time yet. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this episode was about the spies. And wasn't that like the second to last episode of the 94 miniseries?
I think that what they're doing here, I think that next week we are going to get an all Vegas episode. And we're going to get the all Vegas episode told through the perspective of the spies. And so I think that maybe next week might be all about what's going on in Vegas, people that are in Vegas, Trash Can Man. I think that that's what we're going to see in the fifth episode.
Yeah, we definitely, I can't believe there hasn't even been a mention of Trash Can Man. That's kind of weird.
Yeah.
I'm very curious to see how they treat Trash Can Man, given how they have treated disability in this series so far, which mm-hmm. is, you know, slightly better than 94, but still not great.
Yeah.
So, I think that's probably a good call, Rob, although it's weird because I feel like there is a turning point with that whole spy situation. That how are we getting that in the middle of the series? That seems way too early for me. But then I thought all of this was way too early.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the show is telling us, well, we've told you everything you need to know about these three characters now. That's mm-hmm. all. That's all you're getting. Yeah. I don't think we're going to get any deeper exploration into who they are. And granted, we didn't really previously. The novel doesn't seem to care about them very much. But let's talk about what we do know, because I think that's the only path to getting to care about what they're doing in Vegas at all.
Okay.
So I want to start with Dana, who we meet because she is being held hostage, essentially on the road with one other woman whose name we never get to know. Mm-hmm. And Rob, did you remember this scene from the book?
No, I did not.
Because I remember it pretty well, because it's one of these scenes that is in the unabridged version, but not in the abridged version. And curiously enough, the abridged version gives even less attention to Dana than we get either here or in 94, which is, it's a choice. Mm-hmm. We're going to give her this important job, and then that's all you're going to get from her, which tells you how Stephen King really feels about writing female characters, but this was singularly upsetting. And a lot of the Unabridged Stand, one of the reasons I don't like it is because he does go way darker and he gets into some stuff that's like, that's a little gratuitous. And this was one of those gratuitous things.
Yeah.
And you'll be shocked to know, Rob, this is actually a much milder version of what you got in the book.
Mm-hmm. So I did not, obviously this is not in the 94 miniseries, that I did not recall this at all. And I thought that this was perhaps a new invention here for 2020.
Well, it is. It has been tweaked for 2020 in some interesting ways.
Yeah.
In the book, I believe this is a gang of men and there are a few more women with them. They are sort of akin to the Claimers from the Walking Dead universe, just sort of going around and stealing and raping and pillaging their way through the countryside. But the thing that wasn't clear, I think, from this scene, this is one of those things that you really have to have remembered what happened in the book to make sense of what's going on here. They have kidnapped women and they are keeping them sedated so that they can't fight back.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that they're kind of acting a little sedated when the guy brings them out of the truck. Also, why did that guy bring them out of the truck?
Yeah, I think he wants to, maybe here's Harold and he's like, hey, ladies, watch this. I'm going to watch me beat this guy up. And maybe after you watch that guy beat up enough, like sort of like scrawny guys, they say, hey, he's a pretty good fighter.
Yeah, but I think they kind of already know that he's good at beating people up. I'm sure he's had a couple of rounds on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, but they're tied up. He can beat up also like people that are not tied up.
Yeah, it is true.
Mm-hmm.
This is a little bit different. You don't really get the whole like everybody comes together on the road like this. And this is how you're introduced to Dana. She uses the distraction of the caravan rolling up in the book to mount a rebellion. She pretends to take the sedative and then doesn't take it. And she does kill her captor in much the same way that she kills him here. Mm-hmm. But it is nice. I think we could have seen her just getting rescued, which I feel like it's really important that she be the one to sort of rescue herself in this situation and have some agency there. So I liked that quite a bit. But this is all we ever know about Dana, is that she was held captive and raped a bunch of times. And you don't get to hear her grapple with that. You don't hear how it informs how she approaches these situations. You don't hear what she was like before. Like it says in the book that she's a college student and,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, she beat a guy to death in front of you in the book. And that's all you get. So I liked that at least we're keeping that part of it, but the pieces that they added are curious for 2020 because there was not this sort of, there's another veneer of incelness on this guy that was completely absent from previous iterations, where he is talking about how it's like his time to be an alpha, and he all but calls Harold a beta cuck when he's kicking his ass.
I was not expecting that. Yeah,
he does call him a beta, and I'm like, oh, we're doing that now. He's that guy, and I like that choice. To contextualize it and to say like, yeah, this is what this guy, you all know this guy, and this is what he'd be doing right now.
And the whole thing was very unsettling. And, you know, Harold, that didn't we make a point of in the last conversation that Stu had with Harold of like, okay, and I know about that gun that you have on your holster, right? Like, didn't he have like multiple firearms, Harold?
Yeah, I thought he did.
Because I was waiting for Harold to shoot this guy.
Yeah, and there were a couple of times, even if he didn't have the gun on him for whatever reason, like maybe he packed it away in the motorcycle because it was chafing him while he was riding the motorcycle. I don't know. But even if he doesn't have a firearm on him at the point where he's getting beaten up, there's a point where the guy drops the revolver and it's 3 feet from Harold's hand. He could have picked it up and used it. Mm-hmm. And I think we are just meant to be shown here that Harold is a coward and he's not going to do the things. If he's confronted by anybody, he's not going to be able to act.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like we already knew that about Harold, and I'm not sure what purpose this all served.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, this whole thing was wild.
Yeah, it was very wild. And it's also, I'm still baffled that Harold was that threatened by Stu after this like 30-second interaction that he has had with him before. He's like, all of a sudden he says to Franny, oh, are you mad at me and you're not going to date me because of that Stu guy? And Franny's like, what Stu guy? Oh, the Stu guy that I met for 15 seconds 3 days ago that we haven't seen again.
Also, because I'm like, oh, is this maybe, have they gone back? Is this actually now they've met back up with Stu? I did not realize that that was like, no, he's talking about that one interaction that she had with the only other person that we've met in the whole world.
I mean, unless Harold is assuming that Stu is literally the only other person in the world. And he's like, well, we're probably going to run into him again because world's pretty small, literally right now. Mm-hmm. And if we do, are you just going to date him because the second to last man on Earth is a little bit more attractive than the last man? Mm-hmm. Maybe that's his rationale, but he sure seems shaken up by the fact that they met one other person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, he didn't forget about it. Maybe he's like bringing it up all the time. Like, maybe do you think that sort of like he kept talking about like, oh, what are you thinking about Stu Redman again? And then it's like he's like the parent that's like, we don't want you going near that Stu Redman. He's like, oh, sounds interesting.
Yeah. Like the more he brings it up, it's like he's incepting it into her head. And she's like, huh, Stu Redman.
The forbidden fruit.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's almost like, you know who has a crush on him at this point? It's Harold. Like, you're the one that keeps bringing it up, dude. If you just didn't talk about him, you'd be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you don't want him to meet up with you again, maybe don't paint all that stuff on the side of the road.
He's painting stuff on the side of the road, and that on one of the sides of, like, the Mack truck, like, does he have, like, a ladder and scaffolding? Like, how is he getting up there to paint some of this stuff?
I think, does he stand on the motorcycle? Or maybe he climbs up onto the top of the truck and paints it upside down?
I don't know.
Or what if there's a ladder in the truck, Rob?
Maybe.
Yeah, there might have been stuff in the truck he could climb on. I'm not totally sure either. But, you know, they show him in the 94 miniseries. He's like climbs onto roofs and he's kind of a parkour guy. Which isn't... Well... I don't know that
parkour guy.
They didn't have parkour in 1994.
Parkour Lewis can't lose.
I set you up for that one, didn't I? Didn't I? That was pretty good. He does seem to have some pretty death-defying stunts there, doesn't he, Rob?
Yeah. Okay.
How does Banksy do what he does?
I don't know. He's an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah. Harold is the... maybe the greatest working graffiti artist alive in this franchise, Rob.
Yeah.
And we don't know if Banksy made it through.
We don't know. It's like The Rock. We can hope.
It's like The Rock. And maybe there's a third settlement somewhere where all the celebrities went.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that in The Leftovers where they talked about this celebrity, we lost this person, Like, I'm glad that they've sort of like brought like celebrities into this.
Yeah, I do too, because they really, like, the biggest celebrity in the original Stan universe was Larry Underwood, and nobody remembered who he was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It would be fun if they just had, like, some, like, D-list celebrity that was just, like, at Hemmingford Home.
Yeah, or just, like, in Boulder, and they're, like, trying to still trade on their fame, and everyone's like, yeah, mm-hmm. I didn't watch the show you were on.
Yeah. Excuse me, are you Corbin Burnson? Like, yeah, yes. From Celebrity Mole?
Yeah, that's Celebrity Mole too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, or it'd be somebody who is like an Instagram influencer.
Yeah, that's like acts like they're more famous than they actually are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but I think we have a clear candidate for who is going to be most likely to have been an Instagram influencer, Rob. Before we get to that, I did want to talk a little bit more about this scene, about one of the reasons I think we're spending a little bit less time on the journey to Boulder is because everybody's driving.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't do a whole lot of driving in the original. Rob, I'm not sure if you remember, like, they were on bikes and, you mm-hmm. know, and they had motorcycles because there were so many cars filled with zombies on the roads that they couldn't get around them unless they could walk their motorcycles around it. Mm-hmm. But now it's just like everybody's got a car. It's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think there was something in the books. There was like a whole digression that Stephen King had, and it was very boring. It was like when you're like 30 years old and you're writing a novel, and it's like it's only your third or fourth novel and you really care about impressing people, you do a lot of extraneous research. And so he has this whole digression about how, you know, you can't drive a car that's made after this year because you can't hotwire those cars. And here's how you hotwire a car made prior to 1971. And it's kind of like, I don't really care. You could have just made him drive. And so I think the show doesn't really care. We're just going to make him drive.
Yeah. I think that's one thing that I feel like that The Stand did not really nail. Like, where's everybody going in their cars? Like, why did everybody like pack up and they're like, I might understand. Okay, I got to get out of the city. Okay, maybe I get that. But just like all these other cars on the road, where's everybody headed to? I feel like that if there was one thing that we sort of learned from the, you know, pandemic of 2020, then nobody was like in like bumper to bumper traffic trying to get anywhere.
Yeah, people stayed in. Although, you know, again, the extremely competent government in the Stephen King universe doesn't tell anybody there's a pandemic going on. Mm-hmm. So they don't really, there's something in one of the episodes about it, like there's a lockdown, but nobody really seems to be acknowledging that this is happening.
Okay, and so I think that's similar.
It's similar, but yeah. It's not directly the same. And you have people saying, you might have people saying like, oh, there's this thing and it's killing a lot of people I know. Maybe I'll get in my car and go to see my family one last time if we're all going to die. I could see that, but I don't think everybody's going to have the same approach to that. So It wouldn't make sense that there's just cars and cars and cars on the road. Like everybody's going to, if I find out that I'm going to die tomorrow, I'd probably just stay home, right?
I don't know.
Yeah, I want to be here with like my family and my TV, and I will. You know, I'll just like bundle up. I'll get cozy. I'll die in my bed. I'll make it easy for everybody. Mm-hmm. So I do question that. Yeah, it's very dark. But look, Rob, we're talking about a show in which 99.9% of the world's population dies. Mm-hmm. So I think we have a license to get dark. This is the world of Stephen King. Mm-hmm. We are not covering My Little Pony Friendship is Magic, mm-hmm. which is itself darker than you think. But yeah. I digress again. Where was I going with this? Oh. I wanted to call again attention to a scene we talked about last week from the 94 miniseries that they very wisely chose not to do because we don't want to be playing corpses for laughs. But when the power goes on in the 94 miniseries, do you remember this, Rob? We talked about this last week a little bit. There's like all of these people that died in the middle of a task.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, like,
makes a lot of sense to me either of like the person that's like, oh, you know, I'm choking to death on my own mucus, but I'm going to make a smoothie real quick.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's like that many people left the lights on when they died. Again, if I'm going to die tomorrow, I'm going to turn off the lights before I die. Like, I don't want to overload the power grid when people come in and turn it back on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm glad that they dispensed with that because it was just like a stupid gag that was played for, oh, corpses are funny. And corpses are really not funny, Rob.
Mm-hmm.
Although there were more funny corpses this episode than I've seen in any episode of this series to boot. And one more thing about the guy in the tractor trailer.
Yeah.
Like the alpha male. He did something that they did in Walking Dead World Beyond. And for those of you out there who were big fans of Walking Dead World Beyond, Walking Dead World Beyond did something better than another show.
Ooh.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. What was it?
The ruse of being a dead body in a car and then everybody assumes that this is a dead person and they are not a threat, only for the dead body to not actually be dead and to come back and like rob you of all your stuff.
Yeah.
And or your virtue.
Yeah.
So that is something actually the actor Scott Adsit, who plays Pete in 30 Rock, was a kind of a grifter magician type who pretended to be dead in his truck in order to steal the supplies of the group of teenagers in World Beyond. Mm-hmm. And it was almost exactly like shot for shot, the same thing here. And in fact, for a second, I thought I was watching Walking Dead.
Okay. I think you're going to say how he started to suck on Harold's ear.
Ew. Yikes. No.
that was wild too. Yeah.
Yeah. That was pretty wild. Yeah, there's a lot of that that's really kind of not okay. But I thought that this was not a show where corpses reanimated, so it was very startling.
Yeah, I was like, oh no!
Oh no, they really do reanimate. Yeah, zombie apocalypse. But no, that's not a thing. But yeah, I feel like that is probably all that we are going to get of Dana. And it's like, we know enough about her now. You know, some guy raped her and she murdered him. And now she's going to be a spy. And
mm-hmm. She's also a welder. I thought that she's ready to go for Tough as Nails season two.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she knows how to handle a lead pipe. I feel like that's something we saw in Tough as Nails. Maybe not quite in that context.
Mm-hmm. When we first met Dana, she is a welder. She is a tough woman. She's been through a terrible experience on the road, and she still goes to work every day.
And she's still going to sign up to be a spy.
And when they asked her to be a spy, she didn't say, oh, well, really, I've been through so much. She said, no, when do you need me to show up? I'll bring my lunch pail.
She's going to get it done. She's going to get some dirty hands. Yeah. So let's talk about the other spies really quickly, because we spend even less time on spy number two.
Yeah. Who's this lady?
Yeah, this is a lady we've never seen before.
And was this Michelle from Tough as Nails?
Yeah. You know, if I had to put money on anybody from any reality show, like if we are getting a D-list celebrity from a reality show to survive the stand pandemic and wind up in Boulder, it is going to be somebody from Tough as Nails.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of hoping it's Roofer Lee, because they don't really have any roofers in this universe yet.
Yeah.
But if we're not getting Roofer Lee, we could get Michelle. I mean, this woman does have a cardigan and some gray hair, and she's very motherly. So maybe so. But here's the interesting thing, Rob. They have gender flipped this character, too.
Oh, okay.
This was the character played by Ossie Davis in the 94 miniseries. And he's in the 94 miniseries, he's a judge, and he's a retired judge, and he's like a very wise man.
Yeah.
You remember now, like, how his story ends up. You don't even see anything that he does in Vegas.
Yes. So I actually watched a video on YouTube the other day of 10 things you didn't know about The Stand. And they said that guy was actually, he wasn't supposed to be in the movie. He was, that the actor who was supposed to play this part, I think actually had gotten sick and sadly ended up passing away. And he was Ruby Dee's boyfriend.
Husband, yeah.
Oh, yeah, husband, yeah. And yeah. He was just on the set.
Just hanging out, and they're like, well, you're SAG. You can go do it.
Yeah.
And he was great. I wonder, I would love to know who they originally cast in that role, because I always thought, like, his was one of the more, like, he did a lot with the little that he was given. But also, it was another case of there were a lot of people in that movie that, And there were a lot of people at miniseries that were way overqualified for what they were doing.
I feel like in the 94 version, did they meet him on the road? Was he part of the crew with Stu and Glenn?
He might have been. Like, there is a lot of, you do meet a lot more people in that group, and they have like a couple dozen people with them when they arrive in Boulder, I think. Mm-hmm. So that would track. I think they do meet him on the road. There is one scene. There's literally like one thing you find out after Stu and Glenn meet up, and then they meet up with Harold and Franny. There's really one time you see him on the road at all after that. And it's that weird scene where a guy has appendicitis and Stu is unable to save his life.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the judge is in that, and he's like, well, you know, tough break, man.
I think he's there. Yeah,
I think he is there. And then it comes back and it's like, well, we can send that guy, and we never know like what he finds out in Vegas, and he doesn't make it back to Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to gender flip this character as well, except that it's not, because we don't know anything about her. And I also think it's weird that we have gender flipped her, and we've also race flipped her, because, I don't understand, like, if she's not going to be a black man, she has to be a white lady.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we've also, if we had kept this character a black woman or a black man, that kind of changes the tenor of her relationship with Larry Underwood, who is to date the only black guy we've seen in all of Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we could have done with a little bit more of that connection, like find out that they've, you know, he looks up to the judge, and this is why he chooses the judge to be a spy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would change the tenor, and it would actually give that relationship a little bit more flavor. And as it is right now, it's just like, oh, I met this old white lady at the post office. I think she'd be a good spy. Okay. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, are you counting Mother Abigail?
Oh, yeah. Mother Abigail does count.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess.
I think we could do better. I think we could do better. Yeah.
We could do better than two black people in Boulder.
Yeah. How many are in Vegas? I don't think any.
Yeah. I mean, they are probably, I think Vegas probably got all the white supremacists. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We really we don't have any emotional stake in this relationship or this sending this person as a spy. And I would argue we don't have enough of Tom Cullen either. And when you got this scene in the book and when you got this scene in the 94 miniseries, you had a long relationship with Tom mm-hmm. Cullen. We have had literally two scenes of Tom Cullen so far. And so it's kind of like, why do we even care?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little bit annoyed at this, Rob.
Yeah, the selection of Tom Cullen here. So in the 94 miniseries, and I suspect in the novel, so there's hypnosis involved with
yes.
Tom Cullen, right? Here,
yes,
we don't hypnotize Tom Cullen. It's like, hey, well, like he's got this whole monologue, memorized. Why don't we reprogram the monologue?
Yeah, well, I think part of that is because we have realized since 1994 that hypnosis is hot garbage. But I think it takes away also from there's a sense that Tom Cullen is a sort of a supernatural character. Mm-hmm. That they can tap into something magical in him when they hypnotize him and they can program him in that way. But they do it like here. It's just like he's a guy that they'd never expect. And that's all there is to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I had a problem with that as well. Because, again, you've really not seen enough of him to know anything about him or why we would be upset about sending him as a spy.
Mm-hmm.
Except on general principle that if you have somebody who's developmentally disabled, maybe don't send them to their death in Las Vegas where all the Nazis are.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole scene was very weird and problematic. But we should also talk about the other scene, like the sum total of everything we get to know about Tom Cullen, we find out because we do get the scene where he and Nick encounter Julie.
Yeah. Can you go back to I want to make sure I understand. So what was the issue that you had with the with this version of the Tom Cullen sending him to be the spy?
We don't know Tom Cullen at all.
Yeah.
Like he could be anybody. We haven't seen that relationship with him and Nick be anything but two people that are traveling together. We haven't seen like his emotional connection to everybody else. He literally hasn't interacted with anybody but Nick up to this point.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't know. You really don't know a whole lot about him unless you've read the book and you know, like, oh, that's Tom Cullen. Mm-hmm. But that's cheap. That's really cheap.
Yeah.
I feel like you need to see him interact with everybody. You need to see like how he's become the heart and soul of the community. So that it's wrenching to have to send him away. And the way that everybody arrives at the idea that they should send him is, you know, in the book, it makes sense because everybody knows him, but we don't know what they know about him at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Which also it could just be like, oh yeah, you know, that developmentally disabled guy that we met the other day, why don't we send him?
Yeah.
So that is my problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I want to talk about the other scene of Tom Cullen that we get.
Yeah, I do want to say, like, without the hypnosis, this does seem like a wild call to go with Tom Cullen as one of your top three spies.
Yeah, how is he going to not blow your cover there?
Like he's if he gets caught, like, are you really going to count on him to not just say, like, oh, they told me to tell you? It's like, this is like a big swing.
Yeah, they catch him and he's like, oh yeah, I'm doing secret spy business for my friends in Boulder. It'd be like the first thing out of his mouth, it seems like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So we do get the scene where we meet Julie Lowry because she has two important functions in the story. And I guess she's going to get both of them. So that's good.
Yeah.
Here's our Instagram influencer.
Yeah. What's her backstory? Do we get that in the book?
Not really. No, they it's kind of similar. It seems like they're not in a Costco in the book. They're mm-hmm. in like a small town. She's hanging out in a small town drugstore, like just bored. And she's so
was that
bored.
A Costco? I thought it was like a furniture store. You think it was Costco?
Well, they go. There's a bunch of couches in the front, but then they go like they're running down these aisles that look very much like a Costco warehouse situation.
Yeah, they do furniture at Costco.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
I've heard it's good furniture, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, her whole thing, she's a teenager and she's bored and she's excited because one of the people that she's now met is hot and she tries to.
Yeah.
Yeah, she tries to hook up with him. In the book, she succeeds, which is interesting.
Oh.
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
It looked like she was about to succeed here, too.
Mm-hmm.
But then she's interrupted and she is angry because the last two people left alive are apparently a deaf guy and the R word. And she says a lot of offensive things that hurt Tom Cullen's feelings and make Nick angry by association. And then when they say, you can't come with us, she tries to kill them. And mm-hmm. that's pretty much what we got here. Like, it's the same beats.
Same beats. Yeah.
Although I did find it kind of curious how much of the original dialogue they left in, because there's a lot of Stephen King specific language in here that nobody in 2020 would say.
Mm-hmm.
Like, nobody's going to say, I never made it with a deaf guy. Like, who says made it in 2020? And putting aside that it's an offensive word and it's way outdated, nobody says Phoebe anymore either.
Yeah, I have not heard that recently.
No, I have not heard that probably since the early 80s. I mean, she is allowed to swear in this version. She could have just said, I've never effed a deaf guy before. Mm-hmm. It would be fine. I also had something, Rob. I'm going to send you something in the chat here. I'm going to send you an image because I want to play a little buffer snuff, and I'm going to tweet this out as well.
Okay.
I want to show you an interesting choice that I have clocked, an interesting sartorial choice on the part of Nick Andros here.
Okay.
And so I'm going to send this to you in the chat, and I want you to take a look at this. He is wearing something I don't think this was an early 80s thing. This might have been a 90s thing, but what is he wearing in this picture here?
Okay, so I'm looking at Nick, and these are his pants, and then he's wearing overalls with the straps down.
I think he's wearing full on suspenders, Rob.
Okay. Yeah.
Is this 1932?
Does Rob Lowe wear suspenders?
No, Rob Lowe dresses like a normal human being, and you can't remember a single thing he wears. He's very unremarkable.
Hmm. I don't know. Maybe there's no belts. Maybe they can't find a belt.
They're in a warehouse. They're in a freaking Costco. You'd think you could buy a belt at Costco.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't understand this choice.
Yeah, I'm not a suspenders guy.
Nobody is a suspenders guy, Rob. That's the point.
Yeah. I had to wear them for my brother's wedding, and it was, like, very difficult.
Wait, you had to wear suspenders? Your brother got married last year, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he made you wear suspenders?
That was part of the suit that they ordered.
Was this a theme wedding, Rob?
It wasn't a theme wedding that I guess that they did not like the look of a belt with the pants that they wanted. You know, when you are, and I'm sure you've known this from like bridal parties, like you don't get a lot of say. They're like, we picked out your outfit. This is what you're wearing.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I've been in I've been in bridal parties like twice in my life, and mm-hmm. both times they were like, go try on a bunch of dresses and let me know what your top choices are, and then I'll pick something for you.
Okay, well, that is not how it works.
That's not how it works, yeah.
For it to be a groomsman, that they just tell you, like, okay, go get measured, and then we'll tell you what you're wearing.
No, that's not even what Kip did. When we got married, his groomsman asked, what should we wear? And he's like, I don't know, do you own a suit? Mm-hmm. And so we had, like, two navy blue suits and two black suits.
Yeah,
and a variety
cares?
Of, yeah, who cares? Nobody cares. Like, Kip didn't even buy a new suit for his own wedding. Mm-hmm. So this is baffling. This is very baffling and also intriguing to me, Rob, that people in this day and age still wear suspenders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Look, Nick is marching to the beat of his own drummer.
I guess so. Like, maybe, maybe it is a fashion choice, like maybe there's some practical reason to have them, but he doesn't even use them. They just kind of hang. He doesn't use them to hold his pants up because at no point do you see them except when he gets up and walks away.
I mean, he's a skinny guy.
Yeah. He is a skinny
guy. His pants could be falling down.
Yeah. Maybe belts just don't work for him.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the state of his hips are such that belts just don't work.
Yeah.
Is that a thing?
Suspenders are good for one thing. They give you like something to do with your thumbs.
I suppose. As long as they're not hanging by your waist, Rob.
Yeah. Now, this, I don't know what Nick is going for here.
I don't know what that is. Mm-hmm. That just doesn't, that
Flag
doesn't make any
take
sense.
Take one look at this and be like, Mother Abigail, you can have this guy.
Yeah. Like, I think Mother Abigail would be like, no, I'm good.
You're not flag material.
Yeah. And Mother Abigail's like, well, I got a problem with this too. Like, are we sure somebody has to take him? Oh yeah. And speaking of somebody has to take him, Rob, I think we get a little more clarity on the dreams here.
Yes.
Because, Julie does not mention dreams at all.
Mm.
And she is genuinely baffled. And as is Harold, they're generally baffled when somebody mentions the dreams.
Yeah.
And that says to me, like, some people got both dreams. Some people got one dream. Somebody got the other dream. Some people got no dreams? Question mark.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know your theory on this, Rob, because now we've seen a couple of people be taken aback by now that dreams are becoming part of the conversation.
Yeah.
I would guess once you find two people that have had the same dream, they're all going to ask everybody they meet about this.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think some people are going undrafted?
Either undrafted or that maybe, like, it's a lot of work to get into everybody's dreams. Maybe there's some people that they feel like, okay, you're the important people. You get the dreams. Pick up these other people along the way. Pick up the riffraff as you come.
Yeah. Like, you know, collect the, you know,
you got the invite and a plus one. If you meet somebody along the way, you grab them.
Yep. Yeah. Glean them on your way in. And I feel like Mother Abigail would use the word glean because that's very biblical.
This is a big operation that Mother Abigail and Flag are running. They don't have time to talk to every single person.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would imagine that there's probably
middle management.
Some people. Yeah. Yeah. They delegate. And, you know, Flag, as we've seen, is very good at delegating. He just kind of lets Lloyd do all the day-to-day stuff and he's more of a figurehead.
Yeah.
It is interesting, though, because the implication, I think, in the 94 miniseries was that everybody had the Mother Abigail dream or they had the Flag dream. Mm-hmm. Nobody seems to have both unless Mother Abigail is saying we need to protect you from that guy.
Well, who's had none?
Who's had none? I don't know that. I mean, we've seen Harold have one. I don't know if Julie has had one or not.
Hmm.
I think that's our test case here, because also Lloyd didn't have one. What happened to Lloyd was not a dream.
Mm, yeah.
Like, Flag came and got him personally.
Yeah.
But
he
I guess
didn't
that's
recognize him when he showed up.
Yeah, no, he didn't recognize him. I don't think he would have recognized anybody in the state he was in.
Mm-hmm.
But Julie doesn't mention any dreams whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder, like, did she have a dream about anybody, or is she just sort of like at the mercy of whoever decides to take her?
Mm-hmm. Maybe so they're waiting. They haven't had a dream yet.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, again, it speaks to we have to get around to everybody at some point. And, you know, it's one person. Mm-hmm. A lot of dreams to invade.
Yeah.
And there is kind of this sense of, like, people come into these settlements in waves. Mm-hmm. So it's not weird that 6 months into this, somebody rocks up to Vegas and is like, oh, hey, I just got here. Can I have a job?
Mm-hmm.
That's not weird. They're not like, well, what were you doing before? They just assume you're on the road. And
it took me a long time to get here.
Yeah. It was, you know, I
my
don't
car
drive.
Broke down.
Look at me. I'm on a bike.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a long time to bike here from Oklahoma.
Boomer sooner.
I liked that addition as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a ton of pop culture in original Stand.
Yeah.
And I think it makes it a little more relatable. I also, as mentioned, I love Tom Cullen's Dolly Parton t-shirt.
Yeah.
I think that paints a picture as well.
Yeah. That's wild. Tom Cullen's haircut also is interesting. It looks like that he's like getting like his hair buzz like over his ears.
Yeah, that is.
I don't know who's keeping
also,
up with that. I always notice stuff like that on shows of like when people have like very like unusual haircuts. And, you know, I've called this out with The Mandalorian, like different mm-hmm. grooming habits. Are like, how is this being maintained in the fiction of the show?
Yeah. Well, and I think we've talked about that. I know you and I talked about that a lot on Walking Dead as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, how does everybody have clothing that fits them? And how is everybody so well groomed?
Yeah.
It is a question for the ages.
Yes. I don't know if Josh and Mike have covered this on Lost Down the Hatch. How did Sawyer have a 3 or 4 day stubble for the entirety of the show?
I am sure they have talked about this because these are guys that spend 3 hours talking about a 1 hour episode. If they're not talking about that, what the hell are they talking about?
I feel
about?
Like this is the stuff they don't like to talk about.
Rob, is there anything they don't like to talk about?
I don't know. I feel like this is more very much in the Rob Cesternino wheelhouse of nitpickiness about like people's grooming rituals that there is no way they could keep up with on a show.
I don't know. I feel like I've gotten Josh engaged on this topic when we talk Walking Dead sometimes. I know Chappelle really liked to talk about it too.
Oh, good. Okay.
So I think when we're doing Walking Dead now, it's like two against one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So even if he doesn't want to, he kind of has to. But, you know, that also would explain why Josh didn't want to do this with us, Rob. Because we're going to spend 10 minutes talking about suspenders and 5 minutes talking about Tom Cullen's hair.
Yeah.
And his perfectly round beard.
Yeah.
As well.
I mean, like, is Harold stopping to shave every 24 hours? I mean, he's pretty clean shaven in this whole thing.
Rob, that implies that Harold could grow a beard. He's a beta snowflake, remember?
I guess so.
Yeah, I would imagine that it's more like you're supposed to just pretend this is not a concern, but it is big time. Yeah. So, well, let's talk about Harold because I think that's kind of the last
big
piece
Harold
of this
episode.
Big Harold episode. Harold is a little bit inexplicable as a character, though, because he's just sort of getting towed along by his desire for whatever woman is right in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's not the Harold that we know, but I would like to see more conflict in him. I would like to see him have some different priorities here. But he gets a promotion right up top. Stu has decided that now that you've cleaned out all the bodies, which PS you haven't, because we saw like 10 of them this episode anyway. He says that now you can be the cops. Because we need cops in a functioning society, apparently. But Stu informs us, no, he's not recreating a police force. He is reforming the police. This is comprehensive, like community-based, assisting the community rather than enforcing laws of any type. So instead of police uniforms, they are getting ski patrol outfits.
Yeah.
Which I like it. I didn't know it was winter time. I feel like they're going to get hot in these.
Yeah, maybe you think there's some sort of like a ski patrol, sort of like a construction worker vest that they could go with?
Yeah, or what is
very
ski patrol?
Nails.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody, like, if they can't license your tough as nails, if tough as nails can't license your work uniform because it's got a logo on it, I feel like they just give you a construction vest.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, maybe if they give them enough mesh vests to wear over their clothes, they just look like they're playing sequester. But I do feel like what do ski instructors, what does the ski patrol do when it's not wintertime? Like, what don't they, like, I know plenty of them do still bum around Boulder and like work at Starbucks or something, but you know, is there a summertime analog? Could they wear lifeguard outfits when it's summer?
You're asking the wrong person. I do not know what goes on with the Boulder ski patrol.
Yeah. Well, I don't either, Rob. I have been to Boulder in the summer. It seemed like it was full of ski patrol people that were at a loose end.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't wear parkas when it was 60 degrees out. Mm-hmm. That seems like a bad calculation. And also, if you have to chase down a threat, you're just going to like shed the parka as you're running, like you're running towards the Amazing Race, Matt.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Drop your jacket.
You're going to get overheated real fast.
Yeah. We're going to see Nadine pay Harold a visit.
Yes. And this is a weird pickup strategy, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess we have learned that we had the same dream as enough of a conversation starter to go on. So she just has to like hang out on the front porch and be like, oh, hey, I know you had that dream with that dude. Well, I'm going to marry that dude. And I also had that dream. So let's go hang out.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's enough. But I think it's just at odds with the Nadine we've seen so far. I really want to ask you, Rob, how you feel about this characterization of Nadine now that we've seen her a little bit more. It doesn't feel like Amber Heard is owning this. Do you agree?
It does seem like a departure from, you know, where she was at in the last couple episodes that we saw. You know, the whole thing is weird. You know, I'm not necessarily sure why, you know, Harold is just, you know, all in on this plan also. She says, okay, you have to kill Stu and then, Like, I don't know. It's a weird interaction.
It is a weird interaction because I think we're just expected to take it on faith that Flag is working through them. And so they're going to do whatever Flag wants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't know that I... Again, we don't have enough of these characters to be invested in that.
Does this play out the same way in the novel?
Yeah, this is like practically line for line what happens in the novel. That, you know, she just kind of busts in on Harold and tells him, well, I'm a virgin and I'm saving myself for Flag, but anything else you want to do, it's fair game. Let's make out. And then she says, oh, also, BT Dubs, we can make out. And then we also have to do this other thing for Flag, and that is kill everybody. So are you down? And he's like, yeah, totally down. Let's do it. And then they hook up a bunch and then they build a bomb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The ski patrol thing is new. And I like that because there was really not a lot that tied anything in Original Stand to the Boulder area in particular. And it was just like, no, this is a place that's kind of close to Vegas and it's pretty. So we'll hang out here. And I like now that we're incorporating some of the geography. Like, we know that this is a big ski town in the winter. And so there's going to be people around that, like, why would somebody have dynamite in Boulder? Who would have that? This is a fun digression.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. But I do agree. It's a little too fast. It's a little bit.
That's what Nadine thought too.
Yeah. It's kind of like they go from zero to we're hookup buddies that also blow stuff up very, very fast.
They blow stuff up very, very fast. Yeah.
Yes, they do. I mean, they're all about premature explosions here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Very quickly. They're going to go and visit the shack of the explosive, the ski patrol. Vault?
Yep, the avalanche-causing vault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're making... I mean, how much dynamite do they need?
They only need it... Like, they didn't even use dynamite, I think, in the original. I can't remember. I feel like Harold knew how to build a bomb.
Yeah.
Because he was that kind of guy. Or one of them knew, like, where to get C4 or something. Mm-hmm. I got to go back and check on this. But, yeah, it seems like... I feel like Lost has taught me nothing, if not that to do a lot of damage, you really only need one stick of unstable dynamite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, be very careful.
Yeah, just don't handle it. It sweats pure nitroglycerin. It seems like they don't need six crates of it on a dolly. They could probably just reach into one box and get one thing of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that would make it easier to explain when frickin' Teddy wanders in on this
Teddy Wyzak.
Yeah. Teddy would probably still be alive today if they'd just taken only as much dynamite as they needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, he shows up and then Nadine shoots him.
Yeah. And I feel like this was not really earned either. Like we've actually gotten more of Teddy Wyzak than some of these alleged people that are main characters. So at least we know who he is and they've said his name enough times to incept it into our heads, mm-hmm. sort of like Stu Redman. But I assumed this was where we were going with it at the point when he said, well, nobody's going to come up here. The people are patrolling, but I think that's about it. And like, who else is patrolling? Teddy. Of course, we're going to see Teddy. Mm-hmm. It feels a little unearned. And Nadine didn't feel like she owned that either. Like,
yeah,
she
I thought
should
that was
have,
wild. Yeah. Where'd she get a firearm from?
Yeah, she should have been either. She should have handled that firearm like she was born to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
Or she should have been very conflicted about it as well. And you didn't really get either here. She just sort of nervously, like her hands shaking a little bit when she fires it, but there's no lead up to it. And yeah. I feel like I would buy it a little bit more if she was just very casual about it.
Well, would you buy it more if Harold was the gunman here?
Maybe. And especially if Nadine told him to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Harold's whole arc is Nadine telling him to do things.
Yeah.
I like that better, Rob. You're right.
I think he could like pull the gun and say like, hey, Teddy, like just like you didn't see anything here. And then she like tells him like, no, you got to. He saw us. You got to do it. Like, I just feel that Nadine pulling a gun and shooting him. I just thought that was kind of wild.
Yeah, it does. And it also it doesn't track with anything we know about Nadine up to this point. I mean, nothing we saw from Nadine this episode
yeah.
really tracked with that.
You know, even if they went with like the 94 version of you, if you merge like the Nadine and Rita into one person, at least we saw Rita like at the park with a gun, like that she's like has a firearm. But this Nadine, this is the first time at all that we're seeing her that she would even be having a weapon.
Yeah. And especially like they didn't even give the cops weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So I almost feel like there should have been a little interlude there where Harold is told that he should not have a weapon in this capacity in his job, and he gets one anyway, and then it's like Chekhov's gun.
I mean, did Larry have a gun? Like, where'd this gun come from?
Yeah, I don't know who had a gun. I mean, I guess they're probably just laying around. Again, Rob, everybody's stuff is up for grabs in the apocalypse. It's kind of baffling the way that this all went down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was wild. Wild ending.
Yeah, very wild ending. And RIP Teddy. I wonder how quickly somebody reports him missing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are they, I mean, Harold is obviously very good at disposing of bodies. It was his job for a while, but
mm-hmm.
What? How are they going to explain that? Somebody could be like, yeah, hey, where's that guy? I got some DVDs for him.
Yeah. Or maybe tomorrow, nobody else is going to be looking for Teddy except for Harold.
Yeah, except maybe that's the reason that they get along so well, is they're each other's only friend. Or maybe tomorrow The Rock shows up and is like, hey, I had a dream about this guy. He told me to come to Boulder.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be great. Harold also, he plays a big role at the meeting. We didn't really talk about the big Boulder City Council meeting that opens the episode other than in our introduction.
Yeah, and we've talked a little bit about the committee just sort of being up there. And this is also kind of word for word the dialogue that's mm-hmm. in the novel. And because it's also weird Stephen King-y constructions that don't necessarily hold up in 2020. But there is much made of the idea, and especially it's hard to convey without Harold's inner monologue here, but there's much made of like he's going to give himself an important job to do and it's going to baffle everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't think that comes across. And I think you and I might clock it because we've read the book,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't, it's just kind of a weird thing. Like we're not going to give you who Ray Brentner is, but we're going to spend 5 minutes watching Harold put on a tie.
Yeah. What do you think about the inner cutting? I mean, I think we went back and forth like 5 or 6 times between the council meeting and then the prep for the meeting.
Yeah. And it also didn't seem like the meeting was that important.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the school board is meeting.
Yeah. It was like trying to decide, okay, who's going to talk and who's going to say what at the meeting. I did kind of like, I am a West Wing fan. I do like sort of like a little bit of sort of like, all right, like what's the strategy here in this meeting? Like what's our messaging here?
Yeah, well, that's also because you work for yourself and you are your own boss. You do not work in corporate America where you have to
sit CJ?
Through. Yeah. Yeah. I could not watch The West Wing because I need to escape from the world of meetings.
Mm.
And I don't appreciate it here either. They come into this meeting. There's no clear CTA. There's no next steps that they summarize at the end of the meeting. It's just a mess.
Mm.
They don't even know who's going to talk.
Yeah,
like I have to run a meeting on Monday, Rob, and I have it as scripted as a podcast intro because that's like I need to make the most of everybody's time, get in and get out. And this show does not respect anybody's time.
No. What do you think of Fun Glenn?
Fun Glenn is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
He sure spends a lot of time stoned. I feel like that's just all they know about professors. They're like, well, we're just going to make him this sort of crunchy, eccentric guy that's stoned all the time.
Yeah.
Which, okay, fine.
Mm-hmm.
He's funnier than I remember Glenn being.
Yeah.
But I don't buy that somebody that's that stoned all the time is going to be that cynical about the human race.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like you get more mellow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you really going to be that much of a man of science if you're spending a lot of time going, whoa, look at my hand.
Mm. Yeah. So yeah, he's wild. He's like just puffing on that vape pen the whole way.
Yeah, where's he getting all of this? Like he must have had a huge stash. Like his entire backpack must be pot.
Yeah, well, when he heard they were going to Colorado, it's like, great, I'll replenish my supplies.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. That's a good point, Rob. He's probably running a dispensary in his spare time.
Yeah, they probably knocked one over.
Yeah. I'm into it. And again, like, who's going to miss it? Guy that ran the dispensary died in the plague.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, he's excited about this.
Yeah. We had a fun conversation, actually, in the patron Discord today, Rob.
Yes.
Going back up to the top of the episode, we talked a bit about gender-flipping characters. And we had a conversation about which characters could you absolutely not gender-flip in The Stand, and who would be the most fun to gender-flip.
Hmm. All right. I guess let me start with... I feel like that our female characters, I think, are probably the toughest. I think it's probably tough to flip Franny.
Yep.
You mean you could Frances, but you know,
I don't know. She has to be pregnant, so I think she's right out.
Yes. Then okay, what about, I mean, I guess this would involve either, I mean, maybe you could, it doesn't have to be, but I think that Nadine would be tough to flip unless, yeah, you know, it was a guy, but then it, you know, maybe, you know, Flag could have a husband.
Flag could have a husband, but he can't impregnate a husband.
Hmm.
So, or, I mean, most of the time, like 99% of the time, he's not going to be able to impregnate a husband, okay, even though he has powers. Like, maybe he does have powers.
Maybe could Flag be a lady Flag?
Yeah, and we then talked about Lady Flag, and then like Father Abigail.
Yeah.
But that sounds too much. We were playing around with, like, what would their names be? And we decided that Father Anthony sounded too much like a priest, so we couldn't really, I can't see, there's so much duality there with, like, the, you know, the mother figure who binds people together. Like, you don't see, whenever you see a dude binding that many people together, you are suspicious. So I see why, like, given the contemporary state of gender roles, I don't think you can flip Mother Abigail or Flag.
Yeah.
I think you could flip Stu, and that makes it really interesting.
But if you flip Stu, then don't you have to flip Franny?
No, you do not, Rob.
Okay.
Because
this is a wild show.
Yeah. I mean, sexuality is fluid, Rob.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the reason, maybe Harold can delude himself into the reason that Franny doesn't want to be with him is because she likes the ladies.
Mm-hmm.
It adds a new dimension to that relationship. And I don't, I'm going too far down, like, the fan fiction route.
Yeah.
I know you don't have your soundboard up, so you can't play the drop, but it was getting very fan fiction-y, mm-hmm, where I was like, that makes it more interesting.
Stu Red Woman.
Yes. We liked the idea of the crunchy granola pot smoking Professor Gwen Bateman.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the easiest one.
That's the easiest one to do. Yeah. And they could have done that instead of flipping Ralph, or in addition to flipping
Ralph.
Well,
I wonder if they got Greg Kinnear and then sort of, like, tried to, you know, like, in terms of, okay, we got this person, okay, let's, you know, keep this role, yeah, the same, as opposed to if, you know, if they had other people that were attached to this thing.
That's a good point. It was like, we have him to do something, and what are we realistically going to get him to do?
Where else are you going to put Greg Kinnear?
Yeah. I mean, is he going to be Larry? I don't think so. can't be Flag. Greg Kinnear is Flag. That'd be a trip.
Yeah, I don't know if he could pull that one off. So, yeah. You're running out of spots for Greg Kinnear.
Yeah. He's too old to do Stu.
Mm-hmm.
He's too dorky to do Larry.
Mm-hmm.
He's too much of a name to do Ralph.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. They got Greg Kinnear. They had to put him there.
Yeah. I don't think he's Trash Can Man.
Nope. Trash Can Woman would be interesting.
Trash Can Woman you could do.
Yeah. We are getting a Rat Woman, but
yeah,
we're probably getting as much Rat Woman as we are Ray Brentner. So I don't, yeah, think that's going to be as much of a thing.
Okay.
Yep. So is there anything else we want to talk about in episode 4? Yeah. Do we want to make some predictions for episode 5?
I think you could easily do Nicole Andros.
Yes.
I think that's an easy one. And what the female version of Tom would be.
Yeah, I think we could do a female version of Tom, but it would be a very, very different situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think, like, Tom's brute strength is part of his, like, he does a lot of manual labor, and mm-hmm, that's one of the things that makes him valuable in Vegas. That'd be hard to do.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So, yeah, do you have any predictions for episode 5?
Yeah, well, I think it's going to be, we're going to go to Vegas.
Yeah, going to Vegas. Are we going to spend the whole episode there?
I think so. I think that we'll be all Vegas, and I don't think we're going to see any of our principals from Colorado, other than the spies.
Yeah, other than the spies. Yeah.
I think it's all flag. It's we get maybe Trash Can Man's backstory. We check in with Lloyd, and then we see the what's going on with the spies, and then maybe at the end of the episode, word is going to get back to Colorado that they need to get on the move.
Yeah, I think we must get some time with the spies and see what they're doing, or at least see what two of them are doing.
Yeah, yeah, and I think we'll get one spy headed back to Boulder. But I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see Stu or Franny or anybody from the Boulder side of things in this episode. Or if we do, it's not until like the last 5 minutes.
Yeah. Is this going to be like a Tabitha the Goat episode? Where it's like, we left off somewhere where you're supposed to care about what happens next. So we're just going to go somewhere completely different for the next episode.
Well, I think that there is the continuation of, okay, we put the spies in motion and then we will be all about the spies in Vegas.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. And maybe like we're introduced to Vegas through the eyes of the spies.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think it's like that because we have not seen anything going on in Vegas this whole way through. I mean, Lloyd, we saw him in episode 2. We have not gone back to him since then. We haven't seen anybody else, on their way to Vegas. So I think we have to do a lot of catch up with the bad guys.
Yeah, I guess so, Rob. In fact, we might even we're so far past that now. We might even need a big stinger of Lloyd at the top of the previouslys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. What'd you think of the closing credits? What was the song?
Yeah, we got "Give Me Some Kind of Sign." I cannot remember off the top of my head who sings that.
Yeah, but what's the sign?
I think we got Nadine saw a sign. I think we got. I don't know. I feel like that might have been a better thing to give people in a previous episode where they're actually getting signs to do things.
Yeah.
Nadine is the only one who arguably acted on a sign this episode.
I'm starting to wonder maybe we have some songs that this could kind of be related to The Stand. Let's put that in here.
Yeah, we have the rights to that. Yeah.
Get Ace of Base on the line. Can we get some music rights from them?
Yeah, I would have preferred Ace of Base for having songs about signs.
Mm-hmm. And what did you make about that? We didn't talk about this. Lights come back on and we're in for a Larry Underwood, Jimi Hendrix-esque rendition of the Star Spangled Banner.
No, it wasn't even, it was America the Beautiful, which made it
sorry about that.
It made it feel like the bodega version of Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock. It was very weird, but at least Larry is leaning into his musician tendencies, which I think prior to that, every other iteration of The Stand has been like, oh, we don't really care what Larry did before. He's a different guy now.
Yeah.
And now it's like, at least he loves music and he wants to do this. And people either care or don't that he had some success at it.
That was just a wild call for let's when the lights come back up. All right, let's get the amplifier set up. Larry, you go right into America the Beautiful on the axe.
Yeah, I mean, arguably, Larry is the D-list celebrity in this world.
Yeah.
But I would have liked a real celebrity.
I did like that he was able to work the crowd a lot better than Stu. I thought that was a good use of his character and that he would have that skill set.
It's a good addition to his character, too, because I don't remember this being a thing.
No.
And it gives him purpose. It gives him a reason to be what he is.
Yeah.
And it gives him something to do, which he never really had before either.
94, Larry Underwood had no stage presence whatsoever.
No, 94, Larry Underwood was... Yeah, they should have gotten an actual actor to play that guy.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Yeah, so, Rob, what else you got going on this week? I understand that you are joining Josh Wigler to recap one of the greatest cinematic masterworks of the modern era.
Yeah, next week, I'm going to be joining Josh Wigler that we are going to be doing a 2021 look at the many different films of the Star Wars franchise. And Josh has a lot of stuff going on with Star Wars over on Post Show Recaps. But once a month, I will be taking a look back at Star Wars episodes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. A couple of the other ones in the middle there, like the Rogue One. We're going to get into Solo. I think it's going to be a chronological look through the Star Wars universe, and we're going to kick that off next week. I'm going to talk about The Phantom Menace with Josh Wiggler.
This is pretty wild, Rob. This time last year, you had 6 weekly podcasts about an all-winter Survivor season, and now you're recapping The Phantom Menace for post-show recaps.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fine.
Now the 2020s are kicking off in grand fashion, but I think that is going to be a lot of fun. I'm not going to promise I'm going to rewatch that movie, but I will certainly listen to that podcast.
It's fine. And I mean, I'm ready to go, but that my 7-year-old has a lot of Phantom Menace questions for me all the time. So I'm ready to address all of these on the podcast.
And I can't wait till my kid's old enough to watch Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, all 3.5 of the movies.
What's the, so you're counting the original trilogy, and what's the half?
The half, I would probably give him about 20 minutes of 7 and 8 and maybe a little bit of 3.
Okay.
But he actually, we have a Star Wars book that he likes me to read, a little golden book that I have to hide from him pretty soon because it spoils a pretty major plot point.
Yeah.
It's like, really, you're gonna put that in the middle of a book for toddlers that a hero can be a father or a son. You need to know that these kids probably haven't seen the movie yet.
Yeah, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen Star Wars.
Be cool. Yeah, all the toddlers listening to this podcast just got spoiled, Rob.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And over on the main channel, I understand you talked about a Survivor season that nobody likes.
We talked about the 40th best Survivor season. We started a brand new series. We had the listeners of Rob as a Podcast rank the Survivor seasons. People went through, ranked all 40 seasons of Survivor. And we talked about the 40th best one this week on a panel discussion with myself and Chappelle and Chantel Francis. And I thought that it was a very interesting discussion of the blatantly bad, some of the, you know, forgotten good, and, you know, the use of the Island of the Idols in a very interesting discussion.
Yeah, I listened to that. I thought it was a lot of fun. And I think it's a great idea to fill all the time before we get another Survivor season, whenever we're getting one.
Yeah. I like that it does not necessarily, like, you do not need to have gone back and watched the season to listen to the podcast.
Yeah, I agree. Did the work. I certainly did not, and I appreciated
nor
that
you
did.
Do you need to? Yeah.
Yeah, I never will. But I did enjoy the podcast nevertheless.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Anything else you want to share with the listeners?
No, just plenty of great stuff coming up on Robin's podcast, including something I'm also excited about for this weekend. We're having the first ever RenapX, where we are going to be having a series of speakers coming in and giving us a number of Renap-inspired lectures this weekend on the podcast.
Oh, good Lord.
We also dropped the top 10 moments of 2020 from Renap also this week.
This is getting very meta, Rob. I feel like you're like 6 layers into the onion at this point.
So far down. Let's see how deep this rabbit hole goes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, it's turtles all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. It's nice that we're still finding a lot of good things to talk about, even though we don't have the things we wish we were talking about. But I appreciate you talking about this with me here.
Yeah, having a lot of fun going through, and I really am looking forward to seeing what they do with Vegas in the 2020 version of The Stand.
You think they're going to have it at Biff Tannen's Pleasure Palace, or is that played out?
I don't know. I think we might be over that.
What Vegas casino would you choose if you were Flag? Like, where would you want to live?
So, I think that of the Vegas casinos, I'm trying to think of what he would want. Like, I think I'm trying to think of, like, one, like, my first instinct is like something like what's the most like hedonistic one that you could pick, but I don't think that there's really like a classy hotel that really like I wonder, first off, would he go to the old strip, like what's that called, Fremont Street? Yeah, like I wonder if that might be where he's set up more so than like the modern day strip. I do feel like the Luxor, like the pyramid plays into his angle a little bit, but I think that he ultimately goes with Caesar's Palace.
Yeah, that's the classic. In 94, the Strip was not nearly as built up as it is now. So he did go down to Fremont Street and he was at the Plaza, as was Biff Tannen back in the day. But yeah, I think the easy answer is to say Bellagio, but Caesar's Palace is a little bit more classic and a little bit more on the nose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, I'm good with that. If it was me, I'd probably go with the Wynn or the Aria or someplace so I could have something really, really plush.
But, mm-hmm. Yeah. Might be a little too bougie for Flag.
Yeah, Flag. I mean, anybody that dresses like Flag is not going to be comfortable there.
Yeah. I mean, you can't go in an all denim.
Yeah. You could probably go to the Stratosphere in all denim.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Probably go to Excalibur in all denim.
Mm-hmm.
And that looks like a castle, so it's got to appeal to his inner child.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really fun next week.
Yeah, I'm excited for this. I mean, I love Vegas, so I'm happy to revisit it even in post-apocalyptic times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think that about wraps it up here. You can follow Rob at Rob Sesternino. You can follow me at Haymaker Hattie. We'd love to hear all of your takes on the stand so far. Do you disagree? Do you think this is the television triumph of 2021? What do you love about it? What do you hate about it? We want to hear all of that. If you are a patron of Post Show Recaps, please hit us up in the Discord because we're having some really wacky conversations in there, as previously mentioned. But we're going to sign off here, but don't touch your podcatchers because there's more to come in this podcast. Join me for the second half when I'm talking to Meg Ellison. So thanks very much, everybody. See you in a minute.
If you do want me, give me up the show. If you don't want me, don't leave me on the if you need me, show me that you know. Just give me some kind of sign, girl. Oh, my baby, just show me that you're mine.
All right, friends, we are back, and I'm here now with Meg Ellison. She has written four novels, including The Book of the Unnamed Midwife, which won the 2014 Philip K. Dick Award. She's also an essayist, cultural critic, and one hell of a great follow on Twitter. Meg, I'm so excited to talk the stand with you.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you, Jess.
Yeah. So I just want to jump right in here. So I'm a big fan of the Road to Nowhere series, and it really strikes me as it has always felt like it's very heavily influenced by The Stand. And so it was really fun to find out that this was absolutely correct when I saw that you were live tweeting your experiences. So I think we should start things off. I want to find out your history with The Stand in all of its various forms.
That's very kind of you. Thank you. And yeah, The Stand was a huge influence on me, not just when I was writing my first novels, but also as a writer in general. I just discovered Stephen King when I was a little too young for him, which I think happened to a lot of us. Yeah. So I started reading. My mom would let me buy paperback books at the thrift store because they were typically two for a dollar. And I realized that it might be a long time before I got new books. So I tried to buy the biggest and longest books I could find so that they would last. And this led to some strange decisions. So I was about 10 with a backpack full of books like Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, Stephen King's It, Stephen King's The Stand, you know, a couple of Dean Koontz type things.
Did you have any Michener? That feels like a Michener kind of family.
Texas. I had Texas.
Yep.
Yeah. So The Stand was one of the ones that stood out. The Stand and It both got me very interested in cosmic horror, really, as a genre, and in apocalyptic fiction to a lesser extent. And it began a basically lifelong love affair. So I read The Stand for the first time when I was just barely in two digits, and I've read it over 10 times since then. I now have the unabridged edition, of course.
Yeah. So did you start with the abridged edition?
I believe that I did. I had the classic edition with the sword fight, hoe fight on the cover that everybody loves the art from, even though that fight never really takes place and it's definitely a metaphor.
Yeah, there's no swords.
No, I know a lot of people who were disappointed because they kept waiting for the demon fight to go down. But I believe that edition was originally an abridged edition.
Yeah. And so did you watch the 94 miniseries?
I have seen the 94 miniseries. I didn't see it when it was airing because I was, you know, a preteen at the time, but I've seen it since then.
Yeah. And so I presume we can draw a straight line from reading The Stand into exploring this kind of genre on your own.
Absolutely. So I kind of swallowed the pill that a lot of young science fiction writers accept, which says you shouldn't really attempt this genre or your subgenre until you've read all of it, and I mean all of it. So I made an exhaustive study of post-apocalyptic novels that are published in English, and some of it was revelatory and some of it was great and some of it's terrible. And The Stand absolutely figures large in that list of books.
Okay. Well, we're going to come back to The Stand, but I got to hear your list first. What are your like top five?
Oh man. Top five. I love Lucifer's Hammer. I love Alas, Babylon. Mm-hmm. I love, it's a short story by W.E.B. Du Bois. It's called The Comet. The Comet is a lesser known work from the 20s, and it's really about the post-apocalypse and race, and it's spectacular. I would put The Handmaid's Tale on that list just because it was so formative for me to read anything from a woman's point of view. And by the same token, Children of Men by P.D. James.
Yeah, I would have guessed that, honestly, because I always describe Book of the Unnamed Midwife, and people ask me about it. I say, well, it's basically The Stand meets The Road meets Children of Men meets Handmaid's Tale.
That's pretty good. Those are all huge influences for me. Really, The Road should be on that list. I forget to add it sometimes because it was so late for me in that process, but The Road wrecked me. I did not have a normal relationship to humanity for like 6 weeks after reading that book.
Yeah, I don't cite it as a favorite book. I feel like it is a great book, but not one I ever want to read again. It's like, I don't want to go back to that.
No, I don't think I ever can.
Yeah. I never saw the movie. Don't want to.
I watched the movie. It's a very faithful adaptation, and it has the exact same, like, timeless, grim... It's not even horror. It's deeper than horror. It's true nihilism made film. Mm-hmm. And so if you read the book, you don't need to see the film. You definitely got the gist. And there are some images that are best left to your imagination, I think.
Yeah, I don't recommend it. But I want to talk about books that you really do want to see these imagined on film. And I got to hear how you are liking this adaptation so far of The Stand.
I feel like this adaptation of The Stand is really uneven. There are moments of it where I absolutely love it, where I feel like someone totally got the gist of the book and understands it deeply and wanted to bring it not to a faithful adaptation, but to an artful adaptation, because the world has changed so much since it first came out. And then there are lots of moments where I feel like it fails because they've made a casting choice that they thought was bankable instead of the casting choice that they should have made, or because
this questionable choice to tell it all out of sequence. How do you think that plays to someone that isn't familiar with the universe?
This week's episode, it illustrated to me for the first time how slippery that is as a device, especially where you don't have a clear marker of where we are in the story. I think they've been using the progress of Fran's pregnancy to really tell the span of nearly a year of trying to make it into Colorado and then being in Colorado. And the most recent scene where they encounter the group of people that's known as the Zoo in the book, but it doesn't really have a formal name in this adaptation. It was difficult for me to place it in time at first. So you're right that they're taking a huge gamble in telling it out of chronological order, hoping that we'll follow along, hoping that we'll understand, and at the same time, shoveling exposition at us as if we can't put two and two together.
Yeah, I've found that problematic. I do want to talk about the scene with what they call the Zoo in the book, because I think that was the first time I cottoned on to the fact that you were a Stand fan. The first time I read your book, and there are a couple of scenes in there that I think are directly taken from that scene, or you must have had that in mind. And it's a really grim image.
It is a terribly grim image. And even the first time that I read The Stand, even when I was barely more than a child, I remember thinking that Stephen King was almost unique in taking on the asymmetrical nature of gender in the apocalypse. Even if he applied it quite lightly, I think, to the story, he acknowledged that it was there. He knew that that would be a factor in a lot of people's suffering. So when I was writing my own book, I really wanted to focus on that factor in gender identity, gender parity, and in sexuality and all of its forms and expressions. It is awful, and you definitely get the gist of it, and you don't need to spend the whole book doing it, but I clearly didn't think it went far enough, because that is entirely what I was writing about.
Yeah, Stephen King, I mean, it's probably partly just because of his era and his gender and his place in the world. But it's nice when you see him try, but that just highlights all the times when he doesn't. And I feel like it's really like that one scene was just like, oh, well, he went there and now he feels like he doesn't have to go back there.
Yeah, he ticked the box for sure.
Yeah.
I've actually been working on a series of essays about Stephen King's female characters and how desperately uneven they are, because I think some of them are fully realized, like absolutely dimensional human beings. Like, I think Franny from The Stand is an excellent example. Like, she's a whole ass person and we know what she wants and we know what she's trying to do. And then there are many examples of women in his books who do not enjoy the same privilege, and his failures are pretty staggering when you view it in the context of what he's capable of.
Yeah. I remember Rose Madder being like the one where somebody must have gone to him and said, you have a problem with this. And he's like, okay, I'll write one. And then it was kind of like he phoned it in.
Rose Madder and Dolores Claiborne, I think, make an interesting pair of bookends as far as King's treatment of women who are victims of domestic violence. He clearly has something to work that out, to work out about that. And never seems to work it out. Like, one of those books, I think it's Dolores Claiborne, is dedicated to his mother, and that may or may not be exculpatory about anything she experienced or their relationship, but he always seems to be grasping for something that he can't quite reach.
Yeah. So I'm curious what you're making of the adaptation's attempts to rectify Stephen King's uneven treatment of women. What do you think about gender swapping a few of these characters? Have you clocked that yet? Where do you think they're going to take it?
I do like that a couple of places that they've made that decision, I think, have been really meaningful. Ralph Brettner is a minor but important character as far as the establishment and maintenance of the Free Zone. And I love the idea of making that character a woman, and the actress who plays that person is Indigenous, and that's cool because they have very few casting assignments. I really disliked the positioning of Harold as Franny's savior in her early suicide attempt. It violated her bodily autonomy in a way that I wasn't expecting, without being sexual assault, but still definitely made her body into an object. And that doesn't exist in the original text, and we don't need to see Harold save her in that way, because Harold's main selling point is supposed to be that he was the architect of their safe passage across the United States. And that's why he garners all this affection and admiration from men who have never met him. So, weird choice. I don't know why they did that. I think that was, that kind of fucked up the gender balance of how this should have gone. There are a couple of places where I feel like they've made good decisions to make the Free Zone a more diverse looking place. I mean, the book is definitely about a bunch of white guys and also a lady and also
one and black lady.
Yeah, and quite frankly, a magical Negro. Yeah. And he's really bad with that particular trope. Like, he is the textbook example. Mm-hmm. So you can't fix it all the way, but I do think the people who had their hands on it did try.
Yeah. I'm curious. We haven't seen anything of Ray yet. And do you think they're going to flesh her out, or is that about all the Ray we're going to get?
They introduced her. They gave us a full shot of her face. They gave us her full name. So I get the feeling that's planting for later payoff, but I guess it remains to be seen.
And it has to be, because otherwise, why is she like the Cowardly Lion to their Tin Man and Scarecrow and Dorothy?
Right. Yeah. There's got to be something there.
Yeah.
I hope for better.
Yeah, it's been, it was something we actually talked about earlier tonight, about how they're going to gender flip it and then they're just going to edit her entirely out of the story.
I mean, she's still getting her full SAG credit since she is a named character with lines on screen, but I would like it if they'd actually give her a scene. That would be great.
Yeah. So who do you think is winning at being cast, and who is horribly miscast?
I was just talking about this on Twitter last night. The actress who plays Dana Jurgens, whose last name is Martinez, I can't remember her first name, is excellent. I mean, she got a really short monologue and absolutely slayed it, like fully communicated that whole character's, her wants, her motivations, her actions. Like, she's wasted on such a small part, and we all know what's going to happen to Dana Jurgens. I really hope that she has bigger parts in her future, because she's excellent. I don't love the actress playing Franny. I feel like she's playing the character with a very flat affect, when Franny's defining characteristic is the line between her brows that says, I want. How many times does King return to that? And this Franny doesn't seem to want anything. I really dislike the casting of Amber Heard as Nadine Cross. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have the range. I'm sorry. Like, they cast her because they thought she could be a scream queen, and it's not a scream queen role. It needs somebody who is kind of mysterious and kind of witchy. And so far, she's just miserable.
I loved your tweet about we need a witchy Nadine. I thought that was spot on. What did you think of Laura San Giacomo in that role? Because I thought that was a weird choice too.
I think Laura San Giacomo was much closer to my image of Nadine. Like, she does have a certain witchiness about her face. She does have a remarkable, not a generic hot blonde face. Like, you could definitely see her selling crystals or tarot cards or candles or telling you that the end is nigh. Whereas Amber Heard should be telling me that my drinks are ready in first class.
I love that. And I get the sense that the writers don't really know what to do with Nadine here either. They can't decide if she is an architect of, she's just a girl. She's Smurfette.
So the end of this most recent episode, I don't know what your rules are about spoilers. Okay, cool. So the end of this most recent episode saw her take more action toward performing evil out of her own volition than the book ever does. So I think that's a good sign of things to come. Like, she doesn't need to be Harold's semi-slutty attaché and nothing more. Like, she is knowingly doing evil on her trajectory to find Flag. And I think that is a much stronger choice for her as a character.
Yeah, I couldn't tell. And this was Amber Heard's problem entirely, because I couldn't tell if she was doing the evil, if she was conflicted about doing the evil, or if she was casually doing the evil. She just kind of held the gun up and it said blam. I couldn't tell where she was going with that.
I often find that she makes what I believe to be weak choices. And I think it's a question of a well-known actress making a first choice and a director feeling like he doesn't have the leverage to push back. Somebody should push her to dig deeper, and they don't do that.
Yeah, that's probably why a lot of the more minor characters are doing better. We talked earlier today about Greg Kinnear. He seems like he is not the Glenn Bateman that I imagined, and it could be Ray Walston was so good in that role, but
Ray Walston was born to play Glenn Bateman. I really loved him, and I thought he expanded very well into that professorial gray beard voice of the older generation thing. It is a very interesting choice to make Greg Kinnear Glenn Bateman. He is a much like more pot smoking, bangable, recently divorced professor in his 40s. But it keeps him from performing anything like a foil to Mother Abigail, who in this production is not nearly old enough. Like, I love Whoopi. I think she's doing a great job, but she's not fucking 90. You can't tell me that she's even close to it. Mm-hmm. So having Glenn be significantly younger, I think, clears out the question of who is the voice of experience here.
Yeah, it's true. Like, everybody feels younger. And then I was reading, and you've read the book more recently than I have. Is Glenn Bateman really 57 years old in the book? Because
so he is, but you have to remember that meant something different in the late 70s, early 80s. Like, people at 57 at the time that Stephen King was writing this book had been in the same career for 30 years, were deeply established in their marriage. They were pushing their kids off to college because they had kids when they were 22. So 57 at this point is a ripe age for a crisis of masculinity in a man just getting into or just getting out of his second marriage. Like, that number just has a totally different context at this point.
Yeah, and it was also like King was in his late 20s writing this, I think, and 57 probably feels more ancient when you're in your late 20s.
Yeah, 57 is an old man when you're in your late 20s, and you know, we're looking at it now from the ripe old age of 37. I'm like, that's not old. I would date that guy.
Yeah, like, you really can't picture Ray Walston as a sexual being. And I think that was
as much credit. As I hate to rob him of that. Yeah, it's out there.
Look, he always looked 80. He looked 80 in the 60s.
He looked 80 in South Pacific.
Yes. Yes, he did. I don't know. It's that thing where like everybody in the 60s looked 100 when they were supposed to be playing 25, but.
Right, but they, you know, started smoking when they were 12 and they got constant sun exposure and they didn't know anything about microdermabrasion or even moisturizing, and they didn't start signing up for voluntary facial work when they were 30, you know. So we are aging at an entirely different rate. For all that it has changed, we may as well be a different species than we were then.
It's a good point. And maybe that accounts for why Flag is so beautiful too.
Skarsgård. I've never had any kind of interest in having sex with Flag in any of his incarnations before, and unfortunately, I have a Skarsgård problem. If I started dreaming of that dude, I would definitely drive to Vegas.
Yeah, even if you had both dreams and Whoopi's on one shoulder telling you to do the right thing.
I mean, come on. Whoopi Goldberg is a lot of things. She's not seductive. Sorry, no. That's Eric the Vampire Prince of Louisiana. I got nothing. I cannot resist.
Yeah, it's true. I get it. I totally get it. It's a different choice, though. It's not. I never thought of Flag as being seductive in that way. Like, I even thought Nadine was always sort of repulsed by him and intrigued and also repulsed.
Right.
And there's no repulsion here.
None. That's another, like, dimension of the complexity of Nadine that I feel is missing. Like, she's literally just, like, full bride of Satan, utterly convinced that this is the right thing to do. Not at all worried about it. Like, let's just drive straight toward my own complete destruction.
Yeah. What is the term for, like, when you are blinded because you are horny? Like, that is Nadine right now.
There should be a word for that. I know dickmatized is a neologism for it.
Dickmatized. That is the word.
Yeah.
That's motivation at the moment. She's like, I just want to go have sex and I'll do whatever I want. Right. I'll kill a guy if I can have sex.
Yeah. I mean, we've all been there. We've all been desperately virginal in our about 20s.
Been there. Yes. Yeah. For sure. But I want to also talk about Nadine's motherhood. Like, as the character in the book, she is the caretaker of Joe for a time. And then she, you know, she goes off on the Flag quest and kind of forgets Joe is there. And then there's really not much of her relationship with Joe in the miniseries, which made me kind of forget about it for a while. But it looks like we're not getting any Lucy Swan at all. So how do you think this is going to affect Nadine's trajectory?
So Joe is so integral to the story that I'm asking myself the same question, because nobody's really in charge of that kid. Somebody drops him off at school and then Larry kind of has him, and Larry's not responsible enough and is also on the council and couldn't possibly have the free time. Mm-hmm. So missing the Lucy Swan angle, we should have seen a meaningful bond between Joe and Nadine that could then be broken for, you know, dramatic effect. I don't know if you've heard about that, but it's a thing. And the fact that Nadine in every scene looks as though she would just as soon drown him in the backseat of a car as take care of him. And he's not into her either. Like, he's always extremely wary with her and staring her down like, I know what you did last summer. So there's nothing gained there and there's nothing lost. And eventually they're going to ask us to mourn that relationship and there will be no reason to do so.
I think that's emblematic of a lot of relationships in this miniseries. I think they just don't put the emotional stakes on. And I felt that with the spies this week. It was like, why do I care? I've seen Tom Cullen for all of 3 minutes. Why do I care if they're sending him to Vegas?
They literally just introduced Dana Jurgens like seconds before they yanked her out of it. And she wasn't in the zoo. She just exists.
Yeah.
I don't understand what we were supposed to have invested in that. So I do think that it may be a function of the out of order storytelling, but there's a lot of sacrificed pathos here where we should have been made to care about these people before they go to their unfortunate end.
Yeah. And there's nothing there. And especially, I think we don't know who Joe is. Like, we just know he's like some kid that doesn't talk and likes to hug a guitar. He didn't even freak out when he saw Harold, which I thought that was also an important part of his character.
Exactly. Like,
He's
supposed to be the weather vane of this whole thing. Yeah, he's not really the weather vane. There are a lot of pieces missing, and I get it. It's a huge cast and an enormous story, and there is historically an almost cursed dimension to how difficult it is to adapt a Stephen King story with any kind of accuracy. But these characters have meaning, and they exist for a reason.
Yeah, and you know, ABC managed to do it with three fewer hours. They did okay.
They really did. I think ABC elided the right things. Like, there was no reason to include the military presence or interaction with Stu's immediate escape. And I love J.K. Simmons and I love seeing him for a scene, but that had no utility. We didn't need that. We could have used that to establish a relationship that was going to be important later on.
Yeah, we could have just let J.K. Simmons do the Ed Harris thing of being by himself in the room and It's fine. Yeah,
that would be totally fine.
Yeah. So I have to ask the question, since we're talking about the origins, we're talking about everything out of order, but I feel like that's appropriate for this adaptation.
Yes.
It's hard not to talk about this, and especially like you have, because you have explored this in your own writing yourself, and it's obviously a big part of this story. How's this playing differently in a pandemic? Like, we're in the middle of the actual thing that this is about, and it's probably not the right time to drop this, but do you think that the story suffers now that we know how things actually do fall apart and they're not quite the same?
I think the story suffers most in the beginnings of it. I think now that we know what full-scale panic over a pandemic and like overrun hospitals really looks like, and now that we know what that panic looks like on the streets, even for those of us who aren't infected, the fact that the general populace isn't wearing masks is an interesting tell that this, you know, wrapped over a year ago. The fact that, and this has always been one of the flaws with The Stand, but I don't think Stephen King could have known. The problem with King is that his greatest paranoia is that the federal government might be too competent and might mm-hmm. exert too much control over the populace. And it turns out that the emperor has no clothes and no masks and no gloves and no PPE and no plan. and he couldn't have known that. That's not his fault. But it did make for a jarring representation of the early to middle days of a pandemic. And, you know, even one as, although certainly serious, less serious than Captain Trips as ours.
Yeah. I mean, maybe Robert Kirkman had the right idea to just like have you not even find out how that all happened, just accept that it did.
You can really, you can pick up in the 28 days later phase, like Stu is escaping from mm-hmm. Vermont, and we get it in a series of flashbacks or whatever. I think that's very possible. And frankly, having dropped in the middle of a pandemic, probably advisable.
Yeah. And I think that's, as I recall, that's kind of what you did as well.
That is what I did. It's the easiest way. Like it's in media res. You just drop in the middle mm-hmm. of the chaos and find your way out. And people will accept that. You don't have to start with the 30 generations that preceded Jesus so that you know he came from King David. Just start with the part where he's doing a miracle.
Yeah. Or James Mitchell with the geology.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Got South Pacific in there.
Shirley Jackson, where the house is already haunted and everything's gone yes. awry.
Yes, indeed. I agree with that. I think Stephen King just wanted you to accept that it could happen to you. And so he wanted to make sure everybody knew that these people had full lives before the pandemic, but it really.
Which I appreciate. And if you have 1200 pages to go, I also really like what he did with the responsibility of journalism and the absolute crushing weight of the Fourth Estate. Having been a journalist himself, he knows mm-hmm. how important it is for the media to accurately reflect what's going on. And we've seen the consequences of that in our own timeline.
Yeah, we absolutely have. And I was wondering how they were going to adapt that for this era, because it's very different and you got like 10 seconds of it, but
yeah, it should be 80 hours long. Like I would watch a Stand adaptation that was 80 hours long.
Yeah. You could do it. I mean, there were points, and I think my problem was I read the abridged version first. I feel like there were digressions mm-hmm. in the unabridged version that you absolutely didn't need. And he got very dark in points, but he also, you could tell he looked at it from every possible angle. Like, how would every single human who is still left alive, how would they deal with it? And
I love that. And I especially love his attention to collateral die off, like the people who don't die of the plague, how do they die of accident and misadventure? That is, if you don't read the whole thing of The Stand, then I understand if you don't want to, it is a fucking doorstop. And the ending of it is terrible. One of his worst, just an absolute miss. If you read one piece of The Stand to understand why, number one, he's a genius. Number two, it is an enduring work of American literature. Read the collateral die-off chapter. I want to say it's chapter 17, where he explains
the old emergency room blues.
The old emergency room blues. That's the name of it. That is some of the best writing I have ever. There are long snatches of it I can still recite. Like, it cannot be beaten.
The woman that keeps her children, her dead husband and child in the meat locker and then gets locked in there.
Oh, or the woman who doesn't understand that green fuzzy bullets shouldn't be shot.
Yeah, the little girl.
The Catholic daughter.
Yeah.
Oh, the little girl. Yeah, the one who cracks it.
Yeah.
Yep.
It is haunting and upsetting. And it was that and the zoo are the ones where I'm like, did you really need to flesh that out? But you kind of did, and I see why. But
I don't reread the zoo usually. I skip through it. I never skip the old emergency room blues.
Yeah, I do skip the 200 pages about the Rat Man, but nobody needs that.
No, the Rat Man's not great. That's a flight of fancy on his part. And I think I've only read the ending 5 or 6 times. It is just absolute parachute failure bad.
Yeah, well, on every level, I think every ending he's attempted has been bad. The one where he doesn't.
Yeah, in all of his books.
No, in this, in Stand in particular, the Stand where he doesn't really end it, where they're just like they ended on a question mark, and then the Unabridged where Randall Flagg comes to a desert island, and what's he doing with this new one? Have you heard he's doing a new coda to this? Where do you think he's doing that?
As a writer, I have a lot of sympathy for him in this, because when you begin a story that feels big to you, that feels important, there's a certain amount of compulsion behind that. Like, I have to write this thing. And when the idea doesn't come whole, when it comes in parts, you sweat it. If you don't already know where you're going, the ending is definitely the worst part. It's the piece you worry about the most. If you stick it, even if the book was mediocre, people remember it well. And the problem of The Stand is it is a spectacular book with a terrible ending because he never knew where to go with it. You know, 3/4 of the way through the book, again, big spoilers, he kills off like half the people you give a shit about. Again, because he didn't know where he was going. This guy has no map and no plan, and it shows, and the dismount is a knee breaker.
Well, I know this is something you have learned from that, because I feel like you started at the end and wrote your way back. That's how your writing feels to me. Yeah.
I can't ever begin a story. I will never begin a novel without at least a shadow of understanding of how it will end. And when I think about how bad it can go, I think about Stand.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's such a great story and stories within stories. And then it's just like, oh, the hand of God, really? That's literal Deus Ex Machina. And it's not good.
His endings are never in the middle. He never ends a book in a mediocre fashion. It is either pinprick perfect or it's a goddamn nightmare. And The Stand is like a 9-course meal and the best dinner you've ever had and the finest restaurant you could possibly afford with world-class service. And then when it comes time for dessert, someone hands you a roll of toilet paper and tells you you have to eat it.
That's vivid and oddly specific and it's really perfect. So here's the million-dollar question then. So I know that Stephen King's endings can be improved on because all you have to do is look to The Mist for that. Is there a way that you can end The Stand in a way, like what would you do differently?
I think the major problem with The Stand, and maybe this is how he plans to fix it. I have read everything he's ever written. If there's anybody who can predict where he might be going, I would throw my head into the ring for that. For those of you who are not massive Stephen King aficionados, and I'm showing just my Stephen King tattoo right
That's
now.
Amazing.
You might not know that Randall Flagg is a multiverse character. He shows up in lots of Stephen King's work, not always as the main antagonist, sometimes just peripherally. Sometimes he's a minor demon and a nobody and a troublemaker, and sometimes he's the actual bad guy of the piece. He's all over the place. The problem with The Stand is that he wrote it when he was too young. If he had written it as an older man, he could have used it to draw all the threads of Flagg together, plucked him out of the Dark Tower, plucked him out of the Shining, plucked him out of the Crimson King, and braided them all together and made The Stand his last hurrah. I think the ending of The Stand should have been that they figured out a way to kill him. And I mean, kill the idea of him, to draw him out of the multiverse. And I think what it does is restore a beam. This is another deep Stephen King lore thing. Like Stephen King's books posit that there are a series of beams, like axes, that hold the many worlds together, and that they are being intentionally damaged through multiple nefarious processes. I think that killing Flagg in all the worlds at once could fix a beam. And I think if you have a powerful enough set of circumstances that generate not only Mother Abigail, but also interest, the actual hand of God, then the power is there. You're just using it wrong.
I love that. And that's really perfect. I I see. I hope that's where he takes it, to be honest.
Because I hope that's where he takes it. He's been after this guy his whole life. He's been following the man in black across the desert for like 50 years now. Let's kill him.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yes. Yes. 100% yes. And I agree. I think he had the idea in his head way too early, and he should have like written everything else and then come back to it. And now I feel like his last books are just sort of it. He puts Flag in. He doesn't call him Flag. It's just like it's different Flag. Forms of like, here's the yeah. evil nebulous thing. And I'm going to, yeah.
In the best possible world, if I get to go back and be God and reorder this thing, he writes the first 4/5 of the stand when he's like 24. Then he sticks it in a box. Then he goes through. He goes through his accident. He goes through his extremely meta phase and writing himself and his accident into the Dark Tower. And then at the end of his career, when he keeps sending out these piss dribble books that are so bad, as he keeps fading away like a garbage barge sunset. He could have released the stand. He could have used the stand to kill his longest standing antagonist and just blown us all away with his best possible work as he approaches his 8th decade. And everybody would say this is the greatest loss to American literature. He just came out with the best book. You could have published a stand in any decade. Like, it would be so mind-blowing right now. And of course, you know, he couldn't have predicted the future, and I'm sure it made him just an absolute fuck ton of money, and why would he sit on it? And I would do the same thing as an author. But if I ruled the world, I'm going back in time and I'm fixing this.
Yeah. Because he has to write the first part of it while he's still fresh, because if he writes it now, it's going to be 4 aging writers facing down their personal demons and going into the desert to rescue their typewriter.
Don't forget a really boring detective whose sidekick is 10 times cooler than he is.
Oh, yes.
I can hate those books. Yeah, I have read everything he's ever written, but I don't always like it.
Yeah, I skipped a bunch, and then I got into Duma Key, and I'm like, oh, I bet all the last 5 are exactly like this, and I didn't go back.
Duma Key, it wasn't terrible. I didn't hate it. I thought that it returned to some of his Lovecraftian roots of there are many strange small gods in the world and most of them are crazy. It felt like a small hurrah, but his continued interest in crime fiction, it's not what he was meant to do. Like, I feel like he understood that he really wanted to be a musician and it didn't work out and he didn't have the talent for it. And there's nobody to tell him that that same thing is true about crime fiction. But here we are.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate his passion. I'm glad he has interests and hobbies. It seems like that's useful for him so he doesn't slide back into addiction. But yeah,
an incredible heroic struggle. And I really applaud him for going through the added difficulty of sobriety after major debilitating injury and having to take painkillers. And that is no small thing. I want to take not a crumb of credit away from him.
Absolutely.
I just wish the work was better.
Yeah, I hear you on that. So one other thing that you tweeted about that I thought was really, really interesting, just to switch gears entirely here. You talked a little bit about the treatment of Nick Andros, and I think everybody agrees that they should have cast a deaf actor to play a deaf character. But I also clock this in terms of they have changed the way that Tom Cullen is portrayed in a lot of interesting ways as well. And I wonder how you feel about not just how they're handling Nick, but how disability is different in 2020 compared to when King was writing this.
I've spoken less about Tom Cullen because I feel that I have less authority to do so. I'm semi-fluent in American Sign Language. I studied it in college for about 6 years. I have an extensive background in ASL linguistics and in deaf culture. So when I'm talking about the necessity of casting deaf actors and their overall capacity to take on a role like this one, which should have gone to a deaf actor, I feel like I can do so from a place of knowledge and authority. I do think that Tom Cullen could have and should have been played by an actor with a developmental or an intellectual disability. And there are actors who work who have intellectual and developmental disabilities. There are several well-known actors with Down syndrome who could have played Tom Cullen. I don't love the choices that they've made there either. I find that his method of delivering his memorized script, which is meant to keep him safe in the world and was clearly given to him by a caretaker, I don't find it convincing. I don't entirely know where he drew his inspiration for this character from. and it ends up coming off like a non-disabled person who is pretending, because that's essentially what it is. Mm-hmm. I very much wish that if the casting weren't possible, and it's not even that they picked a name, like he's just a character actor. But anyway, if the casting really weren't possible for whatever reason, I wish that they had brought in a knowledgeable disability consultant, mm-hmm. which could have made a huge difference, not only to the portrayal of Tom Cullen, but also to the portrayal of Nick Andros, which I have to say is a mess. There are a million procedural errors in how he is giving and receiving American Sign Language, in Fran's delivery of her duties as an interpreter. And if she interpreted for her brother, which was your clue, I totally missed that. But if that's indeed where it came from, then she of all people should know better.
Yeah, I wondered how accurate that was, because it's not a community I'm familiar with. So I appreciate the expertise. And they had said, like, the directors had been asked, why didn't you cast a deaf actor? And they said, well, there's these scenes where he can hear in his dreams. I feel like that's an easy fix, isn't it?
That is an extremely easy fix. And this is a common misconception about deaf people. Deafness is not a legal category. There is not such a thing as people who are profoundly 100% deaf and hear nothing. And then those of us who hear, there is in fact a spectrum of mm-hmm. hearingness and of deafness. Many deaf people have some residual hearing or have been educated by oralist methods in how to speak vocally. And they do so quite clearly in whatever their language of birth is. There are lots of deaf actors, Niall DeMarco included, who would have been a perfect pick for this.
Yeah, Sean Birdie is right there. Clear speech.
Yeah. Right? There are several actors I could see being pulled for this who are capable of clear speech. It would not have been a problem. They also could have been dubbed. That's not mm-hmm. that hard to do if the actor was really incapable. But most deaf people are educated in mainstream schools, which means they are educated to serve an oralist and hearing world, which is a terrible practice and nobody should be forced to do it. But most deaf people have some amount of bimodal bilingualism, and it would not have been impossible to service that in the script at all. I think it's that misconception that deafness is a binary definition or a binary identity is really a disservice.
And also the misconception that the goal, like, they would be better if they could hear, because I get a lot of that out of it too. Like, in his dreams, he's like delighted. Oh, I can hear. And yeah, maybe he doesn't care. Maybe it's not important to him. And I feel like maybe the dream sequence should have been that everybody else is communicating with him the way that he needs to be. Like, if he walked in and Whoopi Goldberg was signing at him, that would be mind-blowing.
I think that would have been incredibly powerful. Exactly. And I keep thinking about A Quiet Place as a good mm-hmm. example of a piece of art that made the right choice in casting a deaf actress. And in doing so, the other actors learned how to behave around a deaf person, how to facilitate lip reading. They picked up a little sign themselves. And she, in turn, made changes to the script so that deaf people, when they sign, have accents, because everybody who uses any language has an accent. So the result is that everybody in that family has her sign language accent, and they have what amounts to a family set of idioms, which ends up being incredibly beautiful and authentic in a way that even if you're not familiar with American Sign Language, you can tell that there is a cohesiveness. And this absolutely lacks that.
Yeah, that is... And I wondered, like, I liked that they were trying. I liked that they had him sign at all, because in comparison to Rob Lowe, it is a step forward. But how did you feel about Rob Lowe in this role?
First of all, Rob Lowe has only escaped being brutally canceled because the awful thing that he did exists on VHS yep. and not on digital. It's mm-hmm. really just a function of the fact that he did a terrible thing before digital media was extant, and he continues to get it in huge parts like the one in The Stand or like 30 Rock. Or no, he wasn't on 30 Rock. He was on
Parks and Rec.
Parks and Rec, that one. Anybody who's done what he did and admitted to it should not have ended up where he's at in Hollywood now. It's really just luck. So that being said first. Secondly, he's not a convincing deaf person in the slightest. He's obviously just a hearing person who doesn't speak, which is a condition. He might just be mute, but that is not the description of Nick Andros.
No, that's Raj from Big Bang Theory.
Well, it's a whole other thing.
Yeah, it is a whole other thing. But yeah, I feel like they understand that what was on the page was not good, but they didn't take it far enough. For sure.
No, I completely agree. Yeah.
And I didn't know this about you, your ASL experience. That is really instructive. And I find that really, really interesting. And I feel like all they had to do was ask you. They could ask anybody like you. And
I mean, there are people in the world whose job it is to be a certified interpreter and to act as a consultant. And there are hearing people who do that if you really feel as though you can't hire a disabled consultant. But, there's a university on the East Coast called Gallaudet that turns out hundreds of them every year. Like, I'm not even a bona fide expert. I'm like an armchair expert. And it's really necessary for a production where a deaf character is a major character. And Nick Andros really is the soul of this book. And it's such an oversight. And it's only because we shift disability rights to such a low priority in the context of, say, I mean, think about the way racism and casting has been addressed in the last few years. Or think about the way they've hired intimacy consultants to manage sex scenes so that people don't feel as though they're participating in their own assault. Like, all of that's been revolutionized in the last 10 years. And compared to that, our expectation for disability representation is moving at a crawl.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, Stephen King obviously didn't get any of it right when he wrote it on the page, but you cut him a little slack because it was the late 70s and we've moved forward from there, but we're at a different place now. It should be.
We're in a very different place.
Yeah. I mean, they could even just ask somebody that's seen a season of Switched at Birth and they'd get better results.
It's true. I try to give King credit for what he was doing at the time. Like, at the time, having a deaf and mute character who was so integral to the story, who was pretty complex. I wouldn't say Nick is entirely fully human. There's a lot about what he actually wants. He kind of becomes like the disabled angelic character, which is a common trope of the time. But even then, it was a big deal for a mainstream fiction book to make a real, like, decision-making, brave character out of someone with a disability that's so obvious and so defined. When I think about his treatment of, God forgive me, with the way he writes Black characters, I think the same thing. Like, they fall into really difficult and demeaning tropes much of the time, but it was good for him to try. He was trying. He was writing, you know, Dick Halloran and Detta Walker and all those characters at a time when white guys were writing books about white guys. He was at least thinking about it, and it was a difficult time to do that.
Yeah, he understood, and I think he was working with what he had and what he knew. And he's gotten better. He has gotten better.
I would say when he knows better, he does better. And that's what we can all ask each other to do.
It's true of all of us. So, Meg, is there anything else that you want to highlight about your experiences watching this? Anything good, anything bad?
Yeah. In this most recent episode, in the scene where Tom and Nick discover Mother Abigail in her retirement community when she's experiencing a moment of despair, and the three of them come together after having dreamt of one another, when she knows their names, when they know her face, when they realize that this is fate, that was beautifully done. That absolutely came together in an A+ scene. I knew who everyone was. I knew what they were feeling. I knew the importance of it. The cinematography was gorgeous. Like, she's sitting in a room with three corpses and we still get this like golden light in the room. That is the first time in watching this adaptation that I have had anything really move me. That was moving. And, you know, even in most mediocre series never get there. The good ones get there once an episode. And so far we've gotten there once a season. So I am still hopeful that this adaptation of The Stand could take off and be better. I want it to be better.
Yeah, they've really, that was also the first time, like, you never hear Mother Abigail in any other iteration have that much doubt and have that much, like, I think Ruby Dee's Mother Abigail was obviously a very different character. She looks up to the heavens as like, God, why are you testing me? But this Mother Abigail is like, I don't even know if any of this is real or if I'm just like hallucinating it on my way out the door. And when it all comes together like that, I agree. And I think the first impulse is to bristle against that because it's like, that's not how they did in the book. That's got to be different. But it is. It's better because they're saving her at the same time that she is saving all of them.
Absolutely. You get the first feeling of them cooperating as a community. And I'm not, as much as I'm a big fan of the book and I am avidly observing the differences between the way the book was written and this is being adapted, I don't want everything to be exactly the same. I expect this to be its own work of art. I just want it to be good. You have to be good or you have to be good at it. That was one moment where I felt like this adaptation was wholly successful. They got it. They handed it to us. We all felt it. It was the warm little center of existence that we all crowded around. We could get there again. I want to believe. God, we didn't even talk about Harold.
I try not to talk about Harold. I feel like they have adapted him for the modern era. And Stephen King understood some things about that type of man before that type of man was a trope. And
yeah, and he's an incel now, and that wasn't the thing when Stephen King was writing him. The thing that upsets me about Harold, like Harold is an upsetting character. He is meant to be an incel on the edge of violence. He's just a tall, skinny, lurch-looking Elliot Rodger motherfucker.
Yep.
The thing that bothers me about Harold is that he's one of Stephen King's fat characters, which is a point of contention for me because I really think he hates fat people and I hate the way he works it out. But it at least in adaptation provides roles for fat actors. And in this case, we never saw him that way. He was never fat. It is not part of the story.
Yeah. I mean, he's Corin Nemec or he's this guy and neither one of them has an ounce of body fat. It's
no.
Yeah. And even as he in the book, Harold starts out fat and then like as he starts to move toward the light and think about redeeming his character, he loses weight. And
right, because Stephen King loves to valorize weight loss. He loves to make us see that a character is going from bad to good by making them shed weight. This is one of the ways in which fat is really gendered because Stephen King sees fat women as irredeemable and fat men like Ben Hapscom in It or like Harold Lauder in The Stand as maybe salvageable if they stop being so fucking fat. I'm not willing to settle for poor representation for fat people in TV. It would not have made me happy to see the valorization of Hawk's weight loss in this show, but it would have made me happy to see a fat actor get some fucking work, especially after Castle Rock hired somebody thin to play Annie Wilkes.
Yeah, that's a problem. I worry about the source material though. Like even if he doesn't lose weight, to have him be the fat guy that's rejected by the woman, does it turn into because he's fat?
I mean, it is because he's fat, at least partly. Yeah. Like he's repulsive for a lot of reasons, but that represents the reality of especially a fat young man's experience. Like we've definitely made strides in representation for fat women on TV. You know, Shrill is a great show. And there's that character on This Is Us who has like a welcoming and loving relationship. And we're beginning to see fat women as whole people. And we still see fat men as a joke. Mm-hmm. And this could have been a little nick in that, except it wasn't.
Yeah, it turns out he's just an asshole. And
he's just an asshole.
Yeah. And it was hard to have that be your entry point into the series too. Like are we sympathizing with this guy now? Why are we spending so much time with him?
The first couple of episodes made it really look like he was going to be our POV character and that was going to be an uncomfortable ride for me. I'm not interested in seeing the world through Harold Lauder's eyes.
God, no. I didn't like reading about it. I didn't like watching it in the original miniseries. Don't like it now.
Yeah, he's a skin crawl character. He's supposed to be.
Yeah, he is. So is there anything that we haven't seen yet that you're looking forward to seeing? Like, what do you think they're going to handle the best?
I am really interested in seeing the attempt on Flag's Life by Dana Jurgens, especially after being introduced to that actress, who I think is just spectacular. I want her to take a poke at him, and I want it to be meaningful. I really think the mid-book climax scenes in Vegas are going to be a very interesting payoff, and we finally see these two sides clash, not in dream space, but in meat space. And I am also interested in whether or not we're going to introduce Trash Can Man ever, because I am getting the feeling that Lloyd Henreid is going to take that role since we haven't seen Trashy at all.
I think Trashy was cast. I think there is a Trashy in the IMDb.
Is there? I've been trying not to read IMDb because I don't want to ruin it for myself. But if we're going to see Trash Can Man, when and how?
Yeah. Well, I feel like when you tell the story out of sequence, you can't really avoid spoiling yourself because there's so much that they've spoiled for me already.
It's true. Yeah, the jump in the first episode just showing, or the second episode, I think, showing Franny like ready to pop with a pregnancy. I really thought they were going to move that toward a reveal and have us find out when Stu finds out. And I almost wonder if that wasn't constructed in the edit.
Yeah, I would be curious to see a chronological, like, you know, they took Lost and they re-edited it. The fans re-edited it to make chronologically Lost. I would like to see chronologically The Stand.
That would be a project for somebody who wants it worse than I do. God, that sounds like months of thankless work.
I'm amazed Lost, anybody ever does, but
no. And Lost is a side note, I think, is the prime example of directors underestimating their audience. They really jerked us around on Lost. I will never fucking forgive Abrams.
I feel the same way. The Post Show Recaps Network, I should hasten to add, does not share my sympathies, and it has become a point of contention with management and myself. But yeah, I'm still mad at them. And also because everybody saw Lost and decided that's how they have to tell the story. And you can draw a direct parallel between Lost and what they're doing here too.
I absolutely agree. I feel like it ruined TV for probably 15 years. And I so appreciate when I see showrunners throw that out the window. Like, I think a prime example is Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad never underestimates you. Trust that you can put two and two together. Trust that you understand the fucking Kuleshov effect when they throw it at you. It never thinks you're stupid. Lost thinks you're stupid and points and laughs at you the whole time.
So what else are you watching lately, Meg? What can you recommend?
What have I watched that I can recommend? I just got into The Boys on Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. Everybody's pretty superheroed out, and I don't blame them. I was really looking for something that was less prosaic about superhero existence, because I love the Velveteen Verses books by Seanan McGuire. Mm-hmm. The Boys is imperfect and it's really rapey, and I'm hoping they pull out of that as like a nosedive. But it's also very much like Watchmen, in that if you've been reading comic books your whole life, it is fun to watch them be parodied and sent up. Mm-hmm. So I am enjoying that. I can't get enough of The Crown, and then the most recent season was a complete letdown and I hate it.
Oh, I hate that, because I'm like mid-season three right now and I'm loving it.
I'm sorry. I think it's quite obvious that they got just completely screwed over in filming by COVID. So there are a number of things for which there should be a scene, and instead there's a phone call. Yeah, it takes the wind out of the third season pretty badly. And I don't ever want to be made to feel sympathy for Margaret Thatcher. There is no plinth tall enough to make the Margaret Thatcher statue get out of range of people pissing on it. And that includes me.
Amazing.
I'm a serial rewatcher. I like to go back and watch things that have been familiar to me for comfort or for background noise while I work. So I have, in the course of the pandemic, rewatched the entire run of MASH, which was an experience.
Wow. That's an undertaking. Wow.
I went way back. Yeah. It's funny. 3-year war, and it's a 9-year TV series.
Yeah. It has some beautiful moments. They're ahead of their time.
They were ahead of their time in many ways. It is stultifyingly misogynist. I was not prepared to go back into that. It was, for its time, really sympathetic to an occupied and oppressed people. It still manages to be extremely racist. It's difficult for me to advocate for it to my friends because of what I know. I know what it is, but it is deeply imbued with nostalgia for me because I grew up in a military household and there was a lot about MASH that was just part of the background noise in my life.
Yeah, I can definitely get that. And a lot of the stuff of my youth is deeply problematic, and yet there's pieces of it you want to keep for yourself. Mm-hmm. For sure. So, Meg, if we want to keep following your live tweeting Odyssey through The Stand, which I recommend everybody does because she's got it in one thread. You can read through it all at once, and it's amazing. So where can we find you in the social media world?
Just as housekeeping, I would say if you're going to run a live tweet of an ongoing series, you should return to your thread. I think that's a great way to keep a record of where you're at and to let people know you're back at it when the episodes resume. So if you want to do that with me, I'm on Twitter at Meggie Listen, M-E-G-E-L-I-S-O-N, and I use that just about everywhere. If you're interested in the rest of my work, I am at MegEllison.com. I am on Patreon as Meg Ellison, writing short stories and offering writing advice. And unfortunately, on Instagram, I'm Megan Ellison because some Mormon kid is camping my handle.
Oh, A jerk. I hate it. Hate it for you.
It's probably her name too, to be fair.
Okay. I hate it a little less if that's what's going on. I know you have a book out now, Find Layla, which I read and was amazing. Are you working on anything new?
Thank you. I actually have a meeting on Monday about what I hope will be my next book. But I also, in this last year, released my first short story collection with PM Press, which is a Northern California anarchist press. And it has some of my collected essays, some new short stories, and some reprints. And it includes some of my most revolutionary writing about fatness. So if you're into that, please go to pmpress.org and find the book.
Loving that. Very excited, actually. I love the social commentary aspect of that and the politicization of bodies. It's a pet interest of mine for sure. And Road to Nowhere series, is that a trilogy? Are you ever going to go back to that?
I get that question a lot, which probably means I should go back to it. I love The Road to Nowhere, but by the time I finished the third book, I was really done with it and I really wanted to do something else. I have ideas in my head for more books or more works in that universe. I would really like to write the Book of Max, who is the mayor of what used to be Chicago, now called Chi. So here's the deal. If anything gets developed out of The Road to Nowhere that encourages me, and by encouragement, I mean a dump truck full of money, I will go back to it. In the meantime, I've written my next three novels. I'm really into some different things in my current work, and I'm hoping that people who enjoyed those books will enjoy these as well.
I'm very excited. So thank you so much for being with me here, Meg. This is really fun to geek out with you about The Stand, and I can't wait to find out what you think of the rest of the series.
This is one of my favorite things to geek out about, and it's been a real pleasure, Jess. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks. All right. So there you have it. That was Meg Ellison, author of the Road to Nowhere series, as well as Find Layla. And you can find her again on the social media at Meg Ellison. And she was fabulous. I'm so excited. I'm really kind of fangirling all over the place here and really excited that I was able to bring that interview to you. So if you have feedback, Rob and I definitely welcome all of your thoughts on everything that's happened in The Stand so far. And the way you get that to us is you can leave a comment on postshowrecaps.com. You can tweet it at us at Rob Cesternino and at Haymaker Hattie. And you can also tweet the Post Show Recaps account at Post Show Recaps. We want to hear all about how you're enjoying this journey and whether it makes sense to you, especially if you haven't read the novel before. I also want to invite you all to become patrons of Post Show Recaps, because when you support Post Show Recaps on Patreon.com, that helps us keep the lights on. It helps us continue to develop more interesting and fun content like this very podcast. And it also gives you a lot of great patron perks, including at least three extra podcasts a week, sometimes more. There are exclusive live watch parties. There's chances to virtually hang out with Josh Wigler and ask him anything that you want to ask him. And there's also a community aspect, which I think we didn't even anticipate how great this would be when we started it up. We have formed a Discord channel, and patrons at the $10 level and above get access to the Discord, where you can talk to your fellow patrons about just about anything. We have channels for all of the shows, all of the podcasts, and then all kinds of off-topic forums, including pets, vacation. There's one that's just devoted to sharing gifts of garbage for no reason, literal garbage. And then we have the Snacks channel, which is, of course, Josh Wigler's favorite. And eventually every channel becomes the Snacks channel over time. At the $15 level, you get all that, plus you get swag, including a Wigler's Wombats hat. So if you want in on that, I highly recommend it, especially if you're never going to win a wand off in this lifetime, which, you know, it may come back someday, but this may be your last chance to ever own a Wigler's Wombats hat. And I suggest you take it. So to do all of that and to learn more about becoming a patron, you can go to postshowrecaps.com/Patreon or patreon.com/postshowrecaps. Thank you all for joining me for this extra action-packed episode 4 coverage of The Stand. Rob and I will be back next week with episode 5. Thanks all for listening. We'll see you next week.